reason these disturbances, they followed you to a new home is because it's not the house that's haunted. It's your son.
So 1,100 men went in the war. 360 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
Never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
Get another beer. You want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit!
My name is Robert Hawkins. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. Found this. If you're watching this, then you know more about it than I do.
California, stay away from me. Stay away from me. I'm coming here. John Doe has the upper hand.
And on that day, Ahab will go to his grave, but he'll rise again within the hour. He will rise and beckon. Then all save one shall follow.
They're all gonna laugh at you. They're all gonna laugh at you.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, my friend?
It is going well.
Nice, nice. And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
Going fine, Phil. How are you?
Good, good. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Everyone, this is Abe.
Abe, how are you?
I'm fine. Now get out.
Yes. And Connecticut American?
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how are you?
Good. I'm good.
Very good. So a couple of house cleaning things. First off, Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan.
I do. It's a general interest podcast called The Ascansy Podcast. That's spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can find it on Stitcher and in the iTunes store.
And Eric, we surpassed 666.
Did we? Really? I missed it.
Yeah, sweet. On the Facebook group. Yeah, we're up to like 670 now, I think.
That's like
looking down at your odometer.
Yeah.
It's like looking down at your odometer and seeing that's 10,000 in 2 miles.
Well, yeah, and guess who was 666?
Who?
Actress Maria Olson, because she rejoined. Yeah, now that she's acting.
That is sweet. That is so sweet.
Awesome. Yeah, for those who know, we interviewed her way back 2 years ago, right?
Starry Eyes.
Starry Eyes. And unfortunately, last year, circumstances that are for her and only her to know forced her to kind of drop out of the industry for personal reasons and take a job selling light bulbs. And she would periodically drop in on Facebook to let everyone know how fucking miserable she was that she couldn't act anymore. And she finally managed to get back into acting, and I did ask if everything was resolved with whatever forced her to leave, and it was, so she's not being reckless and going back. Whatever it was that forced her out is settled, and now she's free to go back to acting and pursuing her passion, and she...
got a starring role coming up.
Yeah, and apparently got offered a starring role, like immediately got offered a starring role in...
A lead role
in some film or another. Don't know what it is. Don't really care what it is. I'm just happy for her that she's back. And we've seen her in lots of little things. Like, for example, she had a bit role. She was the bartender, I think, in the... Southbound?
It wasn't a bartender. She was a bar patron, I think.
Bar patron, all right. In Southbound and... The Bunny Man Massacre. She was had a part as the bus as a bus driver in that, and you know, so there's lots of things I keep. Now that I know who she is, she's got a very distinctive look, so it's easy to spot her when she shows up. Except it's not that distinctive because apparently she has a twin.
Oh, is that true? That's interesting.
But I don't think the other twin acts. So,
right.
So those Venn diagrams don't overlap.
And speaking of light bulbs, Mike would appreciate this reference, but light bulbs are very cool because when you collect them in Fallout, you get copper, which can create wires and all these other good things. So,
you been playing Fallout, Phil?
Yeah, I went back. I started it up again last week. I know.
Yeah,
it's terrible. It's
I haven't been. I can't do it. I can't.
Sucks your time up. It's crazy.
With another Mass Effect coming out, and I can usually get those done in a couple of weeks, but oh my god, no, I can't do it. I can't.
Yep. Light bulbs. They're very one of my favorite things to collect when I'm going through the wasteland.
Wow, that was a sidebar.
Yes. A couple other things. Mike, you do a genre blog.
Yeah, it's www.unnaturalselections.com. I'm hoping to have something new written up tomorrow. Maybe if we get some snow and I get to stay home, that will afford me that opportunity.
And Mike, what would that be? Since by the time people hear this, it'll probably be up.
Well, I don't want to say it in case I don't get around to it, because then that'll just make me feel bad.
I see. That's fair. And then, Chrissy, you do things.
I do. Do you want me to tell you all the dirty bad things I did this week, or just the good stuff?
Wow.
Let's say that
for a premium episode that people have to pay for.
Okay.
Not us, though, right? We get it for free, right? Because
we just need to know the genre stuff.
Well, I'm imagining some of the stuff with the tentacles might fit into the genre.
All right, let's move along.
All right. I write short, dark fiction, and you can find out more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com.
Excellent. And Abe, you do things, or you do a genre blog, actually.
Yes, I do. It's called The Regular Movie Reviewer. Best way to find it is go to Dr. Sisson's main page, looking at the right-hand side, and you'll find a link to the blog through there. And that is spelled R-E-E-L-E-R, Movie Reviewer. And if you're interested in other topics as well, or other types of reviews or podcasts, you can find all kinds of goodies on the right-hand side of the site.
That's right. So if you forget any of the links that were just mentioned by the co-host, you can go right there and link to them. I haven't mentioned this for a bit, but MJ Preston, author, and been on the podcast a couple of times, has a new book called Dark Passages 2. And that book has a story by both myself and Christy Peterson Schoonover, so people should go check that out. You can find it on Amazon. And one of the latest reviews that came out about a month ago listed my story as the best story. So that was
cool.
Good. Yeah, it was kind of good news to hear that.
Oh, that is really good news.
That's awesome for you. But since we're going to whore MJ Preston around a little bit, he did just mention he did mention on Facebook that his first book, Equinox, just went back into print in paperback.
Yes. Yeah.
So if for some reason you missed it, and it's episode like 3, I don't know what episode you did. Did you do it?
Yeah, it was way at the beginning. Yeah, it's like in the
way back. Well, I did an episode on Equinox, and so if you just joined us and listened to all the podcasts and were wondering why you couldn't get a hold of Equinox, that's why it was out of print. Now it's back in print.
Yep. That's
so
right.
Go buy.
Yep, The Equinox by MJ Preston on Amazon. People should go buy that and Dark Passages together. You get both of them for $20 combined, probably.
Right, and if you're one of those obsessive compulsive people who already ordered the first printing of Equinox, they fix some of the typos and some of the grammatical mistakes. So now, so you're going to have to buy this one because it's the more correct one.
Nice. I have actually a special edition hardcover of it, as a matter of fact.
I do too. I just looked it up. It's episode 41 where we, Phil interviewed him about the Equinox. And I don't say shit like this unless I mean it. It's totally, totally a great book. You should go check it out.
Oh, yeah. It's awesome. Absolutely awesome. Even still today, you get people trying to pimp their stuff for the podcast and, his was an exception. I didn't even know who he was. He contacted me. I said, sure, I'll review your book. And it was just a phenomenal book that I had to have him on. And we did a 2 hours talking just about his book, which was impressive without giving any spoilers. So, what's wrong, Mike? Was the cat again?
Yeah, cat's out on the keyboard and opened like 40 windows. I don't know how, but.
Are you sure you didn't click on that pornography and it spammed like 20 windows?
No, it was runtime error.
Jeez. Oh, anyway, news? Anybody got news? All right, yes, sir.
This is local news, but it's movie related, and I want to talk about it, so I will. there's a new movie theater opening up by me. That doesn't happen very often anymore. It's part of a chain of theaters called Imagine, which apparently are only located in Michigan, Minnesota, and Illinois. They are luxury theaters. This one's opening 2 minutes away from me, and it includes leather power recliners, 100% reserved seating.
I hate that.
Stadium. Why would you hate that?
I hate reserved seating because I just like buying my ticket, and then I get to choose my seat when I walk in the theater.
Phil, with reserved seating, you can still choose your seat when you buy it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just that, you know, the people who got there ahead of you got the better seats, which is kind of how it used to work, too.
Yeah, I know. It's just more complications unnecessary. But anyway, I'm sorry. Continue.
I'm all about it. They have stadium seating, so you don't have to worry about anybody's head in front of you. Huge screens, Dolby Atmos IMAX theater, largest screen stretching from wall to wall, ceiling to floor, surround sound. It's cafeteria-style concessions, including gourmet new options like build-your-own pizza and a nacho station, and self-serve Coke freestyle machine. Choose from over 100 flavors.
Do they sell liquor?
Or grab a slushy drink.
The self-style Cokes. Have you not done the self-style machines yet, Eric?
I have not. I have
He's not in the Northeast like all us sophisticated people.
Oh, my God.
Are.
Once you do that, you will just... You'll be like, where has this been all my life? It's like
they do have craft beers, cocktails, and wine.
Nice.
Now that I'm looking at, and apparently there's a grill there you can order stuff for, and they even have something called the 4-story burger that you can over there. So that is opening on March 18th in Saline, Michigan, and I am very excited about the possibility of watching a movie there.
Very good.
Yeah, I've got mixed feel. I mean, we don't have that quite caliber at the local, like a lot of some of the AMCs got renovated, so we have like the Barker loungers for the chairs, and and we got the Coke stuff, and that's nice, and like, and they have those like the Stubbs membership, right? So you're a premium rewards member,
right,
which lets you kind of cut the line at the concession stand, which on the one hand is awesome, and on the other hand you kind of feel like a dick when you do it. I paid my $12 annual membership fee, so I get to get my large popcorn first.
Okay, but you know what? I have to be fair here. I just convinced two of my friends at work today. Here, our Prime membership is $15 a year. And I convinced them to do it, the Premier membership, because I said, you don't understand. In two movies, you've paid for your membership. Like, why wouldn't you want to do it? Like, what?
Well, they're also not understanding.
I don't feel like a dick because I just stand there and go, you people didn't do the math.
Oh, I know that. I get it. But it's also, but you still feel like everyone's staring at you. Got like the mom with 17 kids going to see the latest DreamWorks animation movie, and they're crying, we're going to miss the movie. You're like, fuck you, I got my reserve seating. And and it's, but
yeah,
the truth
I got no problem with it. The peons can watch me if they want.
Observe, right, and the truth is, and it's, it sucks to say this, but the truth is, you already paid for this. Because the prices are factored in. The reason they can give the premium members discounts is because they're already overcharging on everything else.
Oh,
so,
I know that. But
right. So what I'm saying is, so then why not get that money back? You know, it's if you're paying for it anyway, you just don't realize it.
Stop fucking it up for everybody else.
I'm saying everybody should do it.
All right. We're falling back. Yeah, we're falling back. So, any other news that anybody wanted to bring up besides Eric, new theater that's part of the 1%? Anyone?
it is kind of bougie.
Abe, hey, you got something?
Yes. So, first off, is that we have another theater release coming up on the 24th for a science fiction movie called Life.
Yeah, I've seen the trailer several times.
Yeah, that actually looks pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. That looks interesting and just kind of a little bit like on the premise of Alien, but it's interesting enough that I probably wouldn't go to the theater to see it just because it's a story that looks like it's been done, but I will definitely see it, like renting it or something. I totally
well, if we do an episode on it, you may have to go to the theater.
Oh my god, and then if it sucks, do I get my $10 back?
Nope.
No.
Damn it.
You just suffer with us.
That's right. That's right. So, all right. Yeah. No doubt, Abe. A lot of big releases coming up in the next few months.
One that might be fun, too, is called The Void, which is coming out on April 7th.
Yeah. That one, people were posting and talking about it on the Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. And that one looks pretty cool, too.
I've actually been trying to stay away from the internet because I'm finding my enjoyment of movies to be greater, not being spoiled on them.
Yeah. The social media is a demon sometimes.
Yeah, it is.
Yep.
Yeah, no doubt about it. All right. One other thing I want to mention is we do have a Patreon account, which is basically folks that listen to the podcast, a couple have wanted to donate to the podcast to give back for the many hours that we put in and so forth. And what we did was create a Patreon account, which is www.patreon.com/darkdiscussions, or just go to darkdiscussions.com, and there's a link right on the front page where you can go and donate money to the podcast. And basically, if you donate money to the podcast, we then give back again where you can choose a topic for us to do. So basically, for every $5 that you donate per month, you get to choose one film for us to possibly review. So, for example, if you donate $15, you could choose three films, Cloud Atlas, Love Me Deadly, and Carnival of Blood. Or you could just say Carnival of Blood three times, and they'll be thrown into a figurative hat, and at the end of every quarter, we will pick a film from that figurative hat. In 2016, quarter three, The Howling was chosen by Michelle Barkley, and then we did an episode, and then Q4 was The Ninth Gate, which is an upcoming episode. And since not many people donate at the moment, your chance of us to do a film that you request is pretty good. So people can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or just go to darkdiscussions.com and follow the link there. So I think that's pretty much
No.
Oh, go ahead. There is
a contest going on.
There is, Eric.
Oh, yes. That's my contest. I almost forgot about it. The contest, if you forget some of this, it is all in a pinned post on our Facebook page for Dark Discussions. My cat is the subject of this contest. My cat, Maddie, has started doing something since December now. She's still doing it, and it's freaking me out a little bit, which is that she started intentionally shutting herself in the bathroom. She will go in there, and she will close the door. And I'm not talking just about, like, knock it a little bit. She closes so it latches. And she will stay in there for up to 2 hours if I don't go open it.
I wasn't in there that long when I was a teenager.
Right? And if I peek in there before that, I always find her in the same place, which is sulking in the corner, sitting on the counter, facing back towards the door. And it's really kind of creepy. So the contest is, you, the listeners, should write a story about why my cat is doing this. Write a spooky, creepy, scary story about why my cat is shutting herself in the bathroom and then sulking in the corner. And send it to darkdiscussions@aol.com. Every entry will get their name thrown into a hat. The stories will be read on the podcast. And when we draw a name at the end, somebody will win a Blu-ray copy of the movie Krampus. So that is the contest. And I'm all confused about the word count, so I'll let Phil and Christy talk about that, because I don't care.
Basically, 500 words or less is what would I think is an easy and quick and doable thing. That would be one regular standard page, single spaced is 500 words, and 250, obviously, is double spaced. So that would be pretty much an easy amount. If folks want to do a little more, they could, with no issues there. But to qualify, you can go 250 words to 550. 500 words would be fine. That's called flash fiction, right, Chrissy?
Yes, that's flash fiction, and that's good. And like Phil said, if you go a little bit over, it's okay. You know, we're not going to get your thing that's 507 words and go, you're out. So, you know, it's fine. I think 250 to 500 is good. That's a good flash, solid length. That's not too taxing. So,
right. Yep. And so far, we only have one entry. So, your chance.
Well, you all better start writing stories, because right now, only one person has a chance of winning this this Blu-ray copy of Krampus.
That's right. And so you figure there's only a few more weeks, and if there's only three or four people that submit, there's a good chance you're going to win. So definitely take time and write a story. So,
yes.
Excellent. And that would be darkdiscussions@aol.com is where you send the story.
And we will be accepting submissions until the end of March.
Yep, exactly. Now, I think that's pretty much it. So we can get probably into our topic tonight, which has an interesting story because we're doing it a week later than we expected because everything had to be pushed back 1 week because of an inconvenience.
It's my fault.
Inconvenience that Eric, he had some problems with transportation at the time. So I guess we can probably introduce what we're going to talk about. So Eric, why don't you let everybody know what it is?
Tonight we're going to be talking about the movie Get Out.
You got your toothbrush?
Check.
Do you have your deodorant?
Check.
Do you have your cozy clothes?
Got that.
What?
Do they know I'm black?
Should they?
You might wanna, you know.
Mom and Dad, my black boyfriend will be coming up this weekend. I just don't want you to be shocked that he's a black man.
I ain't never seen you like this before, bro.
Meeting families, taking road trips. Don't come back all bougie, man.
Come back, get your damn pants up to your damn stomach.
So you guys coming up from the city?
Yeah, we're just heading up for the weekend.
Can I see your license, please?
He wasn't driving.
I didn't ask who was driving. I asked to see his ID.
Call me Dean and hug me, my man.
So how long has this been going on, this thing? We hired Georgina and Walter to help care for my parents. When they died, I couldn't bear to let them go.
Do you smoke in front of my daughter?
I'm gonna quit. She'd take care of that for you.
How?
Hypnosis.
I'm good, actually.
You ready for this?
I'm back in the beat.
So look, I go do my research. Apparently, a whole bunch of brothers been missing in this suburb.
But it's cool.
Bro, how you not scared of this, man?
Couldn't see no brother around here.
Chris was just telling me how he felt much more comfortable with my being here.
Get out.
Sorry, man.
Okay. Get out!
Yo! Rose, we gotta go.
Is everything okay?
Rose, the keys. Just get the keys.
I don't know where they are.
Rose!
Sink into the floor.
Wait.
Sink.
Mom, it's a terrible thing to waste.
There's too many white people, I get nervous.
No.
A mind is a terrible thing to waste.
And I will thank Phil, because when my problems did occur, I told him twice, look, this is my problem. It doesn't have to be the podcast problem. You can go do this without me. And he chose to change the topic instead. And I'm grateful to him for this because I would have been bummed had I not gotten the chance to talk about this movie.
Yeah, and to be honest, Eric, you were the one that brought it up in our 2017 genre preview episode that we did earlier this year. So I figured just for that alone was enough to get you on whether or not you liked the film. Either way, I'll just throw out a few things and then Mike can explain who the director actually is because he's more familiar with the topic than I am. But the director and writer is a guy named Jordan Peele. The film stars Daniel Kaluuya. He's a British actor, plays an American here. Allison Williams, the daughter of fake news Brian Williams, and also a co-star of the television show Girls. And then Bradley Whitford and Catherine Keener are the only two other actors I know.
I don't remember the actor's name. The guy who plays the brother? The evil ginger brother?
The brother is Caleb Landry Jones.
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
The friend of the completely. Lil Rel Howery is the name of the guy that plays the friend of the lead.
All right. So Caleb Landry Jones was in, he played Banshee in X-Men First Class, but he also was in Antiviral and Byzantium. Yeah, right. Yeah. And he's become a running joke on the Bloody Good Horror podcast.
Oh, has he? Oh,
yeah, he's just one of the really white redheaded kid that every time he's in a film, they feel the need to point him out.
I see. Well, he does a lot of genre work. The film was, so I forgot about him. He's actually a well-known actor for genre fans. And then Blumhouse Productions, they picked up this film. The film was made for $4.5 million and is now at $84.7 million. Box office, and still this week, which was its second week, I think, at the box office, it still pulled in over 20 something million, which was pretty impressive, especially for a film with little special effects.
I just wanted to interject that I really think what Jason Blumhouse Productions is doing is semi important for the horror genre, because he's kind of hit on something here, which is that you can keep your budget in check, give the people making the movie control, and you end up with a good number of high quality movies that make really good profits. Now, they don't hit every time, but when they hit, they tend to really hit. And he's already had two phenomenal successes this year in Split and Get Out. So I think that's a really positive example to set, showing people that you don't have to spend, you know, $20 to $100 to $300 million on a movie to make it good, and that the horror genre is still one that can make money. So I think that's awesome.
Yeah, and that's a fair point to mention, Eric, because Blumhouse, even when they don't hit, which are films like Creep and Lords of Salem, they become big hits on the VOD market. And when I say they don't hit, I mean they decide not to release them at theaters. While almost every film they've released at theaters, whether they're good or not, have been big money makers. Chris, you were going to say something?
Oh, I was just going to say that I agree with Eric, and I think one of the experiences I've had this year with the past couple of horror films I've seen, like with the success of Get Out, is that I was very encouraged when I left the theater and thought there is still a film house out there, or there are still people out there who are making intelligent, sharp films for reasonable amounts of money that do well at the box office, and they are finding their audience. A lot of stuff that we're seeing now is just not, I think we can all agree, we are seeing things that are just, it's junk and it's making a lot of money, and it's like, okay, but it's junk, which only guarantees more junk. So this is nice, because if this does well, maybe we're going to get more, you know, a boost. So.
And the thing that's interesting about Blumhouse is that they are focusing specifically on genre material, and not necessarily looking for award-winning material. Instead, they're looking for good films that will be highly remembered and that are important for the genre, such as Unfriended or Get Out or other films like Creep and Lords of Salem and whatnot. So, it's really, really interesting company, which made themselves through Paranormal Activity. That was the first film that Blumhouse, or Blum, Jeff, I forget his first name.
Yeah, but let's remember, Blumhouse is also the company that brought us shit like The Gallows. So I applaud them because they're clearly behind the genre. But they are working on it seems to be a shotgun approach of quantity over quality, knowing that you're going to end up with quality releases. They have had a lot more success recently, so I don't know if there's been a change in their approach or how they do things. But certainly the idea of getting cheap, controllable films that they can release to the audience, and they don't need to be a huge hit. You don't need to be – I mean, we'll take a film like last year, like Batman vs. Superman, which, you know, would should have been a huge hit because it made hundreds of millions of dollars, but they had spent so much making the movie – you know, it's debatable whether it actually made much money overall anyway. You know, so here it's keep the costs under control. You don't need to have a big box office return to be a successful film. And even if it's, even if you have shit like The Gallows, that was a bad movie, but it made money and it works.
Well,
for
and I do think, too, it seems to just with like the last couple of examples we just cited, like Get Out. And what was the other one you guys just said?
Unfriended. Unfriended.
And Unfriended. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Clearly. And that was why I remember when we were talking about this on the 2017, what we were looking forward to. And Eric said, I really want to see Get Out. And I was very excited about it. And I remember making some kind of comment saying that. It sounds like the guy who is spending the money to produce these films is putting his money where his passion is and maybe even has an eye for good stuff. And maybe he just didn't have the opportunity where his company wasn't big enough or something like that where he could just take these kind of risks saying, this is really good, I'm putting my money behind this, and now I'm smart enough to figure out how I can still get this good stuff to make money, like Eric said. Because, you know, for a long time, I think Blumhouse, I mean, I don't know, this was, Blumhouse kind of came to the rise sort of before I was on this podcast, so I've listened to you guys talk about him long before I was part of you, or part of Blumhouse. I've listened to you talk about Blumhouse and the history, and there was some time there where I thought you guys might have thought the company was kind of shaky or didn't have a good foundation. I mean, I've listened to all your episodes and they all sort of blur together, but forgive me. And I just think that maybe this guy has an eye for stuff. And maybe we are finally starting to see that he's in a position where he can pick good stuff and do what Eric is talking about. And maybe he's finally found his groove. And that's a good thing for us.
Well, I think there's always a studio, you know, it used to be like New Line, and then Lionsgate took over, and there was that dark period of time where it was Platinum Dunes, and you know, and Blumhouse is the latest one, and we'll see if they do what all the others do, which is eventually, you know, decide that they find a hit that has nothing to do with horror, and they jump out of the genre as quickly as they can. They grab up as many horror films as they can. I can't remember the last horror film I saw in theaters that wasn't a Blumhouse production. You know, sometimes it's ones they started from the beginning. Sometimes it's ones they grabbed off the festival circuit. And some of them are crap, but that's going to happen. But they are getting it out there. And now studios are seeing that these can be profitable. Even if they're not huge hits, they're profitable. And you're going to see them start to mimic that. Now, the question is whether or not they learn the right lessons. And I can see a lot of bad lessons being learned from Get Out.
Okay. That's not an invalid point.
I'm just saying I could see them like coming out with movie like, you know, Return of the Klan, or, you know, it's
yeah.
It's like, no, that's
all I know is that what they've done since Paranormal Activity, which is now a good 7 years or so, I think.
Holy shit! Really?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Fuck.
No, it's longer than that. I think it's longer than that.
Yeah, wasn't that like 2009?
All right, but either way, it doesn't matter. The point is, who cares? What we want to. I'm just trying to make the point, which is, they've been pretty damn good since then, and their model has been working. And honestly, Mike, you know, they may have had some films you didn't like that were successful at the theaters. However, they have been able to get both not only low budget films, but films that have pretty good scripts, you know, well-made ones that are going to. So in other words, they have both things. They have a chance to make a lot of money, but they're also good films too. And so far this year, I think that's what Eric was trying to say, right, Eric? That
they've
hit it out of the park so far this year. Depending on what our opinion is on Get Out, so hey, you should probably go around and say how we heard about the film and whether or not we liked it. So, Eric, why don't you start, since this is the film that you brought up on the 2017 preview episode.
All right. I actually heard about this film from my friend Derek, who is African-American. He sent me a link to the trailer via message on Facebook with a little note saying, "This is my worst nightmare." When I first watched the trailer, for some reason, it gave me the impression that there were ghosts involved with this movie. So I sent him back a quick message saying, "Which is your worst nightmare, racism or ghosts?" And his answer was yes. So
racist ghosts.
So I actually pinged him real quick a couple days ago to ask him if he's watched this movie, and his answer was no. I hang out with a lot of white people, and I'm not sure I want to do that to myself. So I was like, okay, I could respect that. So he has not watched this movie and might not watch this movie at all, but he's the one that turned me on to it. I've been eagerly anticipating it, and I loved it. I went back to see it a second time, and I think second watch of this movie is also good, because you pick up on stuff that you may not have on the first time through the movie. So I heartily recommend this movie. I loved it.
All right. Abe.
I was browsing around looking for, you know, any interesting horror films that would be coming out. And I came across a trailer for this film. And the trailers, I honestly thought did make it seem like it was a ghost story, you know, revolving around the theme of racism. When we just, you know, decided at some point we might be actually visiting this film in an episode, I kind of kept my nose out of it, mainly just so you get spoiled by anything. And I even started seeing how much buzz it was getting. It was doing so well, both in terms of reviews and even financially. And once we decided to do an episode on it, I went down as soon as I could, although we had a couple of delays. It's really good. I played with my expectations. I wasn't certain how they were going to handle the themes, but it did in such a way that was really interesting. And the performances all around were fantastic. It has a nice, good mix of horror and humor to it. This is a really good film. This is probably one of the stronger contenders for some of the top films of, at least horror films of 2017. It was just an interesting take on a genre, you know. It's compared to what how something like this has been tackled in the past. I definitely recommend this movie as well. This movie is something you can definitely check out as soon as you can. It's really, really good, and I'm very happy to have seen it.
All right, very good, Chrissy.
I heard of this when I, too, was looking around for movies coming up in 2017. I saw this on a Tuesday afternoon, and there was quite a good crowd in there, mostly people in their 20s and 30s, which at first made me a little nervous. They were a great audience, but they were completely engaged. I was saying this when you were out of the room. I think there was a lot of nervous laughter at points early on in the film because of, you know, the racial issue was being approached, which was kind of amusing to me because I was thinking like, oh my God, these kids did not grow up with All in the Family. That much is clear. Because if this makes you nervous, you should have watched that. However, they were very engaged, and it was really awesome because when I left, when the movie ended, they all applauded. These kids really got it. And I was thinking to myself, this is their generation's Stepford Wives. This is a solid little 1970s style thriller. It is very much in the mode of the original Stepford Wives, with all of the political and social commentary that statement entails. The difference is in the 70s, that movie was dealing specifically with the Women's Lib movement. And here now that theme has been updated. It was a solidly structured story. The pacing is steady and ratchets the tension well. I really felt it hit all the right climaxes when it was supposed to. The mystery was pretty well kept under wraps until the big reveal. Although I'm such an aficionado of the Stepford Wives that I kind of figured out what was going on. They did put a different twist on it, which was unique and I didn't see coming, and I appreciated that. But I sort of figured out what might have been going on about 25 minutes in. I can't say that for everyone, because I was just looking, I was coming at it from a different perspective. I love the way they keep us on edge in the end so that we're not exactly sure what the ending's going to be. And I'll keep that spoiler free from now. And there were great three beats. I love good three beats. And as in the Stepford Wives, they were used to their full effect. I suspected that there was probably a very heavy reliance on the Stepford Wives. It seemed like there were a lot of specific allusions, a lot of specific callbacks. So the second I got out of the movie, I went home and I put in my original DVD, and wow, the list of parallels I have is absolutely mind-blowing. There's no way that this writer and director was not influenced by the original film. And I think that what he did with this material is really amazing. To update it for a modern audience, to give his own take on it, to tell a little bit of an original story with his own commentary put in. I can't recommend this movie enough. I think it's just stunning, and I just wish every movie were as good as this one.
All right, very good. Yeah, for me, I never heard about this film until Eric brought it up on our 2017 genre preview episode. I haven't really checked a lot of the horror blogs lately or what was up and coming, so I wasn't familiar with it at all until you brought it up, Eric. Since we brought it up in that episode, it was became on my radar and so forth, and then we decided to do the episode. So yeah, I went to see it. And, yeah, I would say this was a fantastic film. Absolutely the best horror film I've seen this year so far. I probably where Abe is, where he says this is probably going to be one of the better films by the end of the year, even though it's so early. The film is that strong that it should still land up on many folks' lists, even near the end of the year when so many other films have come out by then. Even though there is some political or social aspects to the film, anybody who sees the film, no matter what heritage or gender, can relate probably to the lead character based off of not necessarily the things that occur to him because of the color of his skin, but specifically of the awkwardness and how people act, and in a world where he's normal and everybody else around him appears not to be. And it was well done. The acting was great, and I have to say the number one thing at the film was the screenplay. I think the screenplay was absolutely phenomenal. A few nitpicks, but certain things, even within the first 3 minutes, I immediately knew that the screenwriter knew what he was doing. So high recommend, and I agree with everybody else so far. Mike?
I first heard about this, I don't remember what movie I was watching, some random horror movie, probably back in the fall, and they had the trailer for it, and that was the first I'd heard of it. And like Christy, the first thing I thought of, this is the Stepford Blacks. I didn't get the ghost story vibe, but it was going for that. And I thought, wow, this is a really interesting idea, because horror has long had a history of touching on uncomfortable subjects, shall we say. And let's be honest, we have a real hard time talking about race issues in this country. And this has been a running joke in the horror community. You can't have a good horror movie without, killing off a black guy in the first 15 minutes. So the idea of having this sort of as your story. And, you know, I know a lot of black people who are fans of horror films. So, you know, there's such a small number of films that are horror films made by or for black audiences, or, I mean, not that this is specifically tailored to them, but things like Tales from the Hood, there's not a lot. So I think it's an underserved segment of the market, but it's not tailored just to them, right? Not just to the black crowd. And I'm glad that we five white people are going to have a chance here to explain the black experience to people and settle the whole race problem once and for all. there will be nothing awkward or offensive in this at all. But I'm with you, Phil. I think that while this is specifically dealing with the black experience, which we all have so much experience with, but really we've all been at some point the one person who is the odd man out or woman out in the room. And for those of us who have significant others or have had significant others, we've all been at the, let's take them to the in-laws or the possible future in-laws, right? Your significant other's parents, family, to meet them for the first time. Or the first time you go to a family gathering and you're put up there on parade, right? And you're being checked over like a, you know,
well,
prize cow, as they're checking to see are you good enough to make it into the family.
And I think you're right, Mike, that it's going to be a little weird with us white folk talking about this. But at the same time, one of the reasons this movie is so good is that you don't have to have had the black experience, for lack of a better term, to appreciate what's going on in this movie, because it's done so well. Just because of the way everything is portrayed, you understand what a wildly awkward situation it is and how uncomfortable the lead character is.
Right, and I don't think this film, and by the way, it's made by Jordan Peele of Key and Peele, which was a variety comedy show on Comedy Central. Most of their stuff is available on YouTube. I think if you want to get an idea on how they handled race, go to YouTube and look up Key and Peele Slave Auction, and you'll get an idea that they're not angry black guys, right? That stereotype. They aren't guys who hate whitey. You know,
And the other thing too is I think that they took a topic and applied it to something that's important to them, where in reality, like I said, this is the same kind of issue that's been addressed in The Stepford Wives. It could be addressed with anything. You could address the same – you could use the same sort of story to talk about any kind of imbalance in society,
right.
I think.
Right, and that's why –
which is also what makes it good, because
right,
it's not necessarily – right.
But that's why it worked with Stepford Wives in a different way, you know, which was about putting women in their place. And to me, and this, again, speaking as the whitest person I know, this was a lot more about co-opting the black experience than it was about putting blacks in their place, right? This wasn't about send them back to the plantation. This was about, you know, we've heard the term for white people who want to be black.
Yeah.
So we know that, and that's kind of what this is, you know. And blacks are cool, so we're going to co-opt their culture. And Pat Boone is going to sing all the R&B songs. You know, it's a
weird statement. I've always had an issue with that point, Mike. Not what you're implying, because you're not implying anything, but what other people say about that black experience. Because it's like, what does it matter if a woman wants to have dreadlocks, and they're not black, or what's matter? In other words, folks can take things from all different cultures and adopt them, and it shouldn't necessarily be, steal their culture.
I get it, but I can understand why blacks might be more irritated when you get Elvis Presley come along and do what basically black musicians had been doing for years and become such a huge hit. You know, it's to use a very recent example. You know, it's or Eminem become a huge rap star. You know, it's But you can say, no, I see that point,
but I don't know if that's even that valid of a point, because for every Elvis Presley who breaks out, he's just, you know, one huge example. I mean, other folks that happen to be white or black aren't necessarily going to be Elvis Presley. He had a different thing that made him, you know, even transcend what he did. But
you know there are, let's say, you know, the so-called wiggers out there, right? The white people who try to act black, usually young white people trying to imitate black celebrities, culture.
Yeah,
black culture. And I'm not a person who believes in this cultural appropriation horseshit. You know, if you want to eat sushi, eat sushi. I don't care what your ethnicity is. And there are people who say, there was something today where someone wrote a student wrote some letter complaining to this newspaper about how, you know, about women wearing chokers. They don't understand what it represented from, and it's, I don't know, one of those Swede countries where it started as a fashion statement. It's like, who gives a flying fuck what culture started?
Oh, yeah.
Chokers, right?
As a woman, I'm going to jump in and say whoever that kid is an asshole, because I love chokers because they're sexy, and if you can't, and I'm a woman, and I don't give a shit what it meant.
No, but you don't understand.
So
but you don't understand. Women started wearing it to hide the fact that they had goiter scars, and who cares?
Yeah. Okay, whatever, dude. Those people are all dead, so it doesn't matter. Move on. I'm so glad you have so little to do. Would you like to come and clean my toilets, by the way? Since you're such a holy shit.
But as you know, and this goes back to the, you know, it sort of kind of goes back to the thing that I liked about Green Inferno was the making fun of the snowflake warriors. But
and
yeah,
no
so this is
well, the example I was really thinking of when I was bringing up my point was, I remember one of the Kardashian sisters had dreadlocks, and she got ripped to shreds for it, and it's like. It's she just likes the hairstyle. Who cares?
I kind of remember. I might be wrong about my history, but I kind of thought the Spartans wore dreadlocks. I mean,
you know, yeah. So it was.
Just, I don't know. I'm not saying that they were the first. I'm just saying they did it. That's.
And that's the thing. It's like if folks want to listen to blues music or rap music or country music or whatever. I mean, does it really matter? I don't know. It's
right. I mean, the whole point is that we want. It should be flattery when you've got. You know, I got all these little white kids in suburban New York reading manga comics and you know, watching anime, or the Doctor Who nerds, and you know, it's, you know, it, or you know, right. You, I mean, Star Wars, you get culture spreads. It just does.
Well, it's not
a bad thing.
Like you know, Spike Lee, like 30 years ago or 20 years ago, because that movie's that old now too, talks about. In one of his films about, you know, the white kid, your favorite, who's your favorite baseball player? You know, and they say a black fellow, or who's your favorite musician? You know, they say a black fellow, you know, who's your favorite actor? You know, Denzel Washington, whatever. And I don't see that as a problem. And I don't know what Spike Lee was trying to say, whether, you know, is he doing identity politics by saying where these folks are better than those folks, or is he saying that white folks shouldn't idolize black folks and black folks shouldn't idolize? I don't know. Well, I don't know what he was trying to say.
Well, here's the thing, though: you cannot watch Get Out without thinking there's some sort of statement being made about cultural appropriation. Unless you're completely oblivious. It's in this movie for sure.
But I think
even more importantly, I hope that every white person who watches this movie has the same moment that I did during that party, where I was like, "Oh God, I probably did something exactly like this when I was younger."
Yeah, I am willing to bet that. All those things that were said to the character at that party were probably drawn directly from Jordan Peele's or the writer's experience. And by the way, Jordan Peele is technically mixed ethnicity. I don't know what his other heritage is, but so he's not 100% African. But my point is, I don't think it's necessarily going with strictly cultural appropriation. That's cultural appropriation.
But this is what I wanted to say, which is offline. You said to me after I saw the film, I texted you, and I said I liked the film, and you mentioned that it was possibly also a commentary on white liberals.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure.
It's completely different spectrum than the usual, what's usually portrayed, you know, because a lot of times when we deal with racism in a lot of the media and films, it's usually about more extreme Nazis or skinheads or some shit like that, Ku Klux Klan. It's usually that side of racism that's, most portrayed in media. Yet the other side, a more subdued and much more chameleon-like racism is usually never really portrayed that often. And it's a different, it shows a different side of racism that's a lot more hidden beneath a surface of smiles.
Yeah, I mean, look, I had second year I taught, we had parent-teacher night, and I had a girl who was dating a former student. It was my second year. So a student from I had the year before. The girl was white, the boy is black. Now, the boy was a drug-dealing scumbag, and it was a bad idea for her to be involved with him. It had nothing to do with the fact that he was black. But parents come in, the first thing, and we know that dad has a problem with her dating this boy. So the first thing that dad does, he comes in, he said, "Hi, I'm Mr. Jones." Not his real name. "Hi, Mr. Jones. I just want you to know right off the bat, I'm racist. I don't believe my daughter should be dating the black kid." Now, it's like, okay, there's that kind of racism. That's not the kind of racism that they're talking about here. They're not talking about the green room kind of racism, right? The neo-Nazis. This is the you're racist because you're oblivious kind of thing.
Well, right? And it's also worse than that, I think. And I had a whole bunch of examples here because that opening conversation when he meets the father is so creepy and so uncomfortable because he's saying all these very ingenuine, solicitous things. "Look, here's Hitler and Jesse Owens and my dad was there," or whatever. I was like, my God, dude. It was so kiss-ass and so disrespectful. And the whole, "I would have voted for Obama for a third term." It was just, it was great. But the reality is a real non-racist, someone who isn't racist, doesn't notice that the person they're talking to is different, doesn't care. Makes no mention of it, makes no effort to segregate that individual, and makes no effort to beat down their confidences by placing them in special assistance categories and instead treats them as equals.
I truly
feel as that this is what that was saying. "Oh, we're open-minded. We're not judgmental. But, you know, you're black. But look how much we love black people. Because, look, my dad was with Jesse Owens and Hitler at the same time." What? Like,
Jesse Owens outran my dad. Right.
Well,
exactly.
And,
hilarious. I mean, but it's true. That's the kind of stuff. And I don't know, being in white bread Connecticut right now, I see that go on all the time. So this, to me, was really funny. Because
white,
I was like, oh, God, I see that all day at the supermarket.
I have to white bread liberal Connecticut. You have to have the word liberal.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Well, and if I can just make one quick caveat here, and I will talk more about Stepford Wives as the night goes on.
Oh, please not.
But
so much.
The original Stepford Wives, there's a scene, the whole scene where the dad is doing all of this, right? And then later in Get Out, right? In Get Out, they have the party, and the guy says, "Oh, I love Tiger Woods."
Don't say too much about Stepford Wives. I haven't seen the film yet, but go on.
Okay. And anyway, I love Tiger Woods. Well, I have to say some things about Stepford Wives, Phil, but it's not going to ruin it for you. I just want to say that all of those uncomfortable, solicitous, ingenuine comments that were made, there's a scene in the Stepford Wives, in the original. Phil, close your ears for a second.
Okay.
Where the gossip columnist comes out and sees Joanna and Bobby, and this is what she says. "Have you heard the news? It's spreading like wildfire. A black family is moving in. We are the most liberal town around. We were the first town in Fairfield County to have a Chinese restaurant. That's their definition of liberal.
Right. This is like.
But I lived in Fairfield County. That the original Stepford Wives was actually filmed in my county. Like, I drive past the house every day where they filmed it. Like, so it's just interesting because I have a very special connection to that film because it was filmed right here. So anyhow, but it's just hilarious because that scene in particular, I was like, oh my God, this is exactly what he was talking about, Peele, in his movie Get Out. And it's almost like it's the same issues. You know what I mean? It's the same issues, and it's what, 40 years later?
Yeah, and this is he's trying hard. If you asked them, and honestly, not that they're putting up a front with, I don't remember the character. Chris is the character's name.
Who, the lead character?
Yes.
Okay, yes. I'm not sure, but
it's Chris. Yeah, okay. All right, so I don't think they were just putting up a front for Chris. Meaning, I think if they were alone with their other white friends, they wouldn't use an N-word. They would believe themselves to. They love black people, right? When he says I would have voted for Obama a third time, he totally would have, yeah. Right? This is the way I see it. But it's when they finally do get a black person in their little white community, it's just so painfully awkward that they're trying to say, oh, look how much we like black people. I voted for Obama. My grandfather was beat by Jesse Owens, and we're going to work in everything because everything about your life has to center around the fact that you're black, and so we're going to bring our black experience into your black experience.
Yeah.
and it's
condescending. It's exactly.
Yeah.
Unintentionally, but they're doing it.
It is creepy. The dad is so creepy. The dad reminds me of Diz in the Stepford Wives, and that conversation, it's the same thing. He comes in the kitchen and he goes, I love watching women doing little domestic chores.
Ew.
Yeah, but that's exactly the kind of feel you get. You get that feeling when the dad is talking to him.
Two things real quick. one is that I found myself throughout this movie really wanting the dad to be Michael Gross, but he wasn't. For some reason, I just thought
looked like him. He was giving off that Michael Gross kind of vibe. I will give you that. Absolutely.
Who also played a liberal progressive, by the way.
That's right. Family Ties. And also, he had a particular sequence of dialogue that I really want to discuss in detail near the end of his tour of the house with Chris. So if we could please reserve that for me later, I'd appreciate that.
Let me ask you this. I'm pretty sure none of you have, but I've been what's that word?
Woke?
No. what did you just say? I didn't even know what he said.
He said woke.
Oh my God.
Woke? I don't
woke is woke is because Phil, apparently you don't associate with liberals. Woke is sort of the term for people who've been made aware of their social inequalities and social injustice.
I try to avoid liberals.
It's a snowflake term.
I avoid those people. They make me sick. I've been profiled many times.
Can't imagine why.
well, I'll tell you why, Mike. I'll tell you why. Because I am a ethnic-looking white person. And so I am always mistaken as... I guess a minority in a sense. So I've been at the airport. I was put against with a group of like 10 or 15 Indian and Muslim folk because they had to go through all our stuff, and I was thrown in with them.
Phil.
It should be. I've been called spick numerous times in my life, and I've always been asked my ethnic heritage continuously, for a number of reasons, mostly for my looks or my last name. So,
and the dreadlocks.
Yeah, right.
Phil, the moment that you said your favorite film was Serbian film, that's what got you on the watch list.
No. I said it was one of the best horror film of the 2000s at the.
Well, that's what I'm from, the favorite film of that year.
Right. I could relate to a lot of things. This happened. Obviously, it's a completely different thing because I can still pass as a white guy and I am a white guy. But all the things from the cop and the parents and all that is just annoying as hell. I can see how the importance of this film for the fact that it shows the aspect of the passive aggressive racism or bigotry rather than, as Abe said, the skinhead.
Well, and I don't even know if it's passive aggressive racism. I think it's unknowing racism. These people don't feel racist. They don't think they're racist.
But they're
being racist, and that's the kind of weird part about it.
But that's the thing, and they are in a sense a form of bigot because having experienced it myself, that's how I felt. Most of the times, though, I could deal with it like this guy did, where he just rolled his eyes and said, "Yeah, whatever, you know, don't worry about it, whatever." But he still knows what it is, even if he just rolls his eyes and deal with it. And that's
I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, that was it. Go on.
I was just going to say, there's also a great scene in this movie later with the comic relief, the friend of the lead, Rod, who goes to the police because his friend has gone missing. And of course, this is an intentionally comic exaggerated example. But it's kind of pointing out how when black people point out something racist that somebody else did, it's very easy to end up looking paranoid and crazy, even though they might be right, because a lot of racism is so subtle, like in the form of everything that happened in that party. You know, nobody's using the N-word, telling Chris that he should be a slave or whatnot. Everything, or the racism that's happening there is very subtle, but it's still happening. But yet, if he were trying to explain everything to somebody who wasn't there, he would sound like he was paranoid. And I think that's what that scene with the police officer, it was trying to kind of parallel when Rod tries to convince the cops that his friend has gone missing.
Well, and if I could say just one quick thing about the cop, too, in the beginning. I very quickly got the sense that, and I think that's a nice echo at the end, because there's that moment of uncertainty at the end, which I don't want to ruin right this minute, but you guys know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
But there is a moment in The Stepford Wives where the car drives through the town. There's the one cop sitting there talking to another Stepford wife in front of the sign that says, "Welcome to Stepford." The car drives by and the cop literally gives him like a death stare, and the cop comes back in later. So I thought that was an interesting parallel too, in that he wasn't just being suspicious. I think he almost had other motives maybe, or other, like, I don't think he was just randomly like, let me check his license because he was black.
I think
I wonder if there might have been a little more going on there.
We're talking about two different cops, Christy.
No, the cop at the beginning.
You're talking about the cop at the beginning. I was talking about the black female cop partway through the movie.
Oh yeah, I'm talking at the cop at the beginning. Yeah.
Oh well, I have to say that yeah, I mean, honestly, what the cop did at the beginning wasn't necessarily out of the ordinary, though. Then again, I'm the dark white guy out of all my friends, so I'm going to have that happen to me anyway. So it's like, okay, whatever. So it felt natural to me. But it also doesn't make any sense what Allison Williams' character was saying, because he wasn't driving. It's a deer. It's not like they were driving, doing anything illegal. So I don't know what the deal was, but I could understand why felt...
I'll explain it to you later.
Oh, so you're thinking he worked with the people?
No. Well, I'll explain it to you later after we're past spoilers.
Yeah, okay. Nobody. Look, if he was driving and hit the deer, the cop would not have asked to see her license.
Right. Exactly.
Right. Yeah.
That's why I'm thinking it's an ethnic thing.
Right. Oh yeah. Absolutely. And that's sort of the point. And it's. And again, it's a matter of, you know, was he doing, oh, there's a black man, I better check his license, or was it just that on some level, he's like, hey, I haven't seen too many people like that around here, and therefore that seems suspicious to me that maybe I should check this guy out, which is on a subconscious level as opposed to a conscious level. And I think there's just a lot in this film that, if you're a white person, they don't make the argument that all white people are evil, they don't make the argument that all white people are racist. They're certainly not saying that you're all Klansmen, but they're kind of saying that there's a lot of racial insensitivity that's going on, and stop it. You know, it's understand, we're just people, right? That's the big spoiler. Blacks are people. You know, I just want you to be aware of the stupid shit we do, and they're laughing at it, and we should laugh at it because we are all. Do stupid shit like that too, right? I mean,
yep.
Right. Yeah, and that's what I was talking about when I was, you know, during the party. I was just thinking to myself, I am not entirely sure I have not done something like this myself. Oh God, that
right.
sucks.
Well, Eric, when I met you in person 2 years ago, I felt like you were being profiling me. I felt it. No, I'm just kidding. Sorry.
Well, I feel when I met you, I just thought you looked like you walked right out of West Side Story. So
there you go. my sister, my niece, were down in Tennessee because my brother almost died in a motorcycle accident. Someone drunk, white trash motherfucker hit him, and him and his wife almost died. And then his wife is filled with tattoos, and he has a number of them as well, and. My sister and niece, when they came back from Tennessee, no disrespect for Tennessee because I've been there, it's a great state. They felt that they were being treated negatively by the hospital staff because the sister-in-law has all the tattoos and the rest of them has Hispanic, meaning my sister and my niece and my brother. So, I wasn't even involved in this, and they're telling me that they felt the same stuff that I have had happen to me throughout my life too. So it's kind of interesting that it happens and it exists, and so the profiling, whether it was in their imagination, it could have been in their imagination because I didn't believe it, but it could be legit. You know, I don't know why. I went off on this minor tangent, but it just reminded me what you were just saying, Mike. That
that's another good example. It's not just you don't have to just be black to experience that kind of sort of profiling, and tattoos are another good example.
Phil, just so you know, I don't judge you because of the color of your skin. I judge you because of your fucking accent.
So, Phil, here's what I really need to know.
I am Caucasian, Eric.
So, Phil, if somebody was saying that you look like you were from West Side Story, does that mean you're a shark or a jet? Because that's really important. I have to know that.
Well, I'll tell you the truth, Chrissy. I've never seen the movie, but I think...
My God!
Rita Moreno's in it, right?
Oh, my God,
yeah.
Phil.
Yes,
yeah, you
is.
Need to see it.
I try to avoid musicals as much as possible.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought you were more of an Officer Krumke type myself, but that's okay.
Holy shit, that's actually funny, Mike.
Not familiar with the movie. Not familiar.
Yeah,
I missed the reference.
It's a West Side Story reference. So, okay. Yeah, I'm a straight white male who loved West Side Story when I was a kid. So I still do, but I just haven't seen it. 20 years, but anyway,
I was watching Taxi Driver at that age,
and you were watching Taxi Driver. I was watching West Side Story.
That's right.
That's why I pay too much attention to costuming in films. But
all right, so now that we're an hour into the episode, should we read the wiki for the movie?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and throw out the spoiler alerts. I think we should go with some specific.
I'm sorry,
read it. All right, the very short wiki for this on IMDb is, wiki, a young African-American man visits his Caucasian girlfriend's mysterious family estate. I think that does an excellent job of giving you the basic outline without giving anything away.
Agree.
So we're throwing up the spoiler flag. All of us recommend this movie. So if you haven't seen it yet, I would encourage you to go and see it as spoiler free as possible. Because now we're going to start talking about details.
Sex slaves! Sex slaves! I told you! Sex slaves!
What did you just say, Mike? I didn't even hear you.
Sex slaves.
Oh, about sex it. Slaves. Yes, yes.
Which right. is actually also a reference to the Stepford Wives. But
oh,
yes,
my
we'll
God,
get there.
Stop.
Oh, no, the whole movie is. I'm telling you, there was so much in here. It's awesome. It's awesome, awesome,
and it was.
Awesome,
it is one of the many, one of the movies. He mislisted a bunch that were, Jordan Peele basically said, like, these are like the films that inspired him. That was certainly one of the ones that was on the list.
But oh, but he's a genius.
Give yeah. credit to the author of Stepford Wives, because that was
yeah.
a good one.
Well, no, it's not even that. It's just that the illusions were so well done, and they're so worth talking about, because this is the kind of stuff that I think makes a really good artist, writer, or filmmaker when you can reference other masterful works, and it's not plagiarizing, it's not stealing, it is referencing them in a certain way that gives a context to your own work. And I just can't say enough about how well that particular thing was done in this movie. This guy's a genius as far as I'm concerned. I'll watch everything he does. This is amazing. So
I will agree he's a genius.
Yeah.
Next up, he's doing Human Centipede 4. No.
Jeez.
No, he's not. Just be clear.
Hey, the first two Centipedes were damn good films, in my opinion.
Oh my god!
Third, I had this. That was a film. One of the few films in my life I stopped after like 20 minutes. I go, okay, I'm done. This is stupid. All right,
I was smart enough.
Back on track.
Start it.
Well, it was free on Netflix, and
yeah,
and I go out at least.
Because obviously, it says free on Netflix. It must be good.
No, I saw the first two, and they were awesome. And then the third one I heard was horrible, but I said, you know what? I'll give it a chance because the first two are so awesome. And it was terrible.
Well, look, if you watch the first two movies in a trilogy, it's like stopping. It's like saying, shaving a haircut and not finishing it. It's just, yeah. Exactly. You have to. You just got to do it.
Anyway. All right. So let's talk about this Get Out film. Maybe we'll do an episode on the Human Centipede films in the future. But donate on Patreon and so choose Human Centipede, and we'll do it.
Oh,
episode.
God, please don't.
It's actually good films. So let's talk about this film here, Get Out.
First of all, I got to say, this was like we talked about this when Phil went away, but he turned off the recording. This was like the best audience response film I have seen in years. This was a crowd that was, now it was a Friday dinner time showing. Usually we catch matinees on the weekend, or so we usually don't get that big a crowd. So we had a good crowd in a packed theater, but it was, they were into the film. They were with it. They laughed at the stuff they were supposed to laugh at. They cheered. They applauded at the end when you get the final confrontation with the villain. They were like thrilled. They were like, yeah! You know, it's like they were really, 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 really into this movie. And that made it in what was an enjoyable film that much more enjoyable for me.
But Mike, technically, does that demonstrate a side of human society being a terrible thing for cheering the death of people, even if the people are guilty?
Nope.
No.
Shouldn't they all just be arrested?
Can we just not even go into the big deep let's just go.
All right. I want to bring up the first scene of the film.
Phil, when we get to that, I'll explain why I understand why they cheered that on more than you know, dealing with any other villain I've seen, you know, in recent years.
Yeah. Well, last time I saw something like that, Mike, because I did not have that type of audience when I watched it. It was a fairly normal audience, you know, quiet, you know, relaxed audience. But the Total Recall, I remember seeing that
with Sharon Stone.
Yeah, everybody went nuts every scene when.
And there's a reason, and there's a connection to that, I think, and besides the fact that it was women.
No, not necessarily the Sharon Stone one, but the Michael Ironside when his arms got ripped off.
Oh, okay.
People cheered that one even more than when Sharon Stone got her ass kicked. and after watching that film, my buddy said, that was awesome. I go, but why isn't it sick that people are cheering when someone's arms get ripped off and blood is fresh? And he goes, oh, I guess so.
We know it's fake.
I know. It was all in good fun. B-movie madness. Anyway, let's get back to this film. I have to say, the first scene in this film, I immediately knew this film was going to be a fucking great film because it was so well written. There were some issues where the character, basically, let me set it up. There's a guy who happens to be of African-American or Caribbean-American descent walking the street at night in what appears to be a affluent or middle-class suburb neighborhood, where he feels, based off of some exposition he says to himself, he does not feel like he fits in, meaning it's probably a non-diverse neighborhood, most likely white and so forth. So he's walking the street, and this car comes by blasting this music, oddly old-fashioned music, and it begins to follow him, and he's like, not a fucking gun. And he turns around, I thought, because a film could have had him start running or sneak into someone's yard or something like that, but he does something very interesting, which is he turns around 180 and starts walking back. So obviously the car, the only way it could follow him is to do a three-point turn. But when the camera pans, we see the car parked and the door open and no one there. And it's like, no fucking way. And I thought it was awesome because it did not occur to me that it was going to play out that way, because I was expecting the three-point turn or something like that. And it didn't. And I mean, for whatever reason, that alone made me think this is a great screenplay for such a little simple scene like that. Go on, Kara.
I was just going to say, I think I can, I agree with you 100%. That's when I knew we were in for a treat. But I think why it was so cool was because it was a very unexpected reversal of what we are normally used to. I mean, here we see this really nice, quiet, suburban, like you said, gently lit neighborhood, as in a beautiful, quiet suburb, as opposed to a lot of times in horror films when we see these opening assaults, or even on something like NCIS or a crime show, right? They usually show you a harshly lit, by sodium light, urban landscape or something like that, and then this violent attack happens that you would more expect to see in a harsher, more urban landscape. And I think that was really well done. I mean, even the street lamps were like, seriously, they were like something you'd see in Main Street in Disney World. So it was very interesting to see the paradox there.
Well, it sucked you right in. And that's where he was trying to go. But that didn't work for me or matter to me, because I grew up in an area of Massachusetts, which every town has their own, you know, football team where everybody hates each other. So if you're from the town of Westford, you hate the town of Chelmsford, who hates the town of Tingsborough, who hates the town of Lowell, who hates the town of Draken, and on and on.
We hate Shelbyville.
So, yeah, exactly. Just like The Simpsons. So when you're walking down the street and you see a car, you're apt to see a car. If you're a high school kid walking down the street in any of the towns that Abe lives around, and this happens to you, you're expecting it to be the next town's kids in their high school jackets to jump out and beat the fuck out of you. Well, all I was saying was, I see your point, and that's exactly what he's going for. Your point is the reversal, but
not experience wise, but just reversing what we're normally used to seeing in the average trope is what I was trying to say. That's what I meant.
But for me, the thing that made it work wasn't all that. The thing that made me, not the ironic nature of the reversal, I thought the thing that made it work for me was the fact that I felt like that guy that was like, oh, fuck, now we got the Westford kids, they're about to jump me. But he was brilliant to turn around, walk the opposite way, where the only way the car could get him is to do the three-point turn. But instead, the person in the car or people in the car were smart enough to just pull over and then come around through the bushes and get him from behind. And I thought, as a suspenseful moment rather than the ironic moment, made the scene for me, and therefore made me say this is going to be a good screenplay. But what you said about the political aspect and the ironicness of the black guy getting jumped by the white guy versus in a suburb versus a white folk in an urban setting getting jumped by whoever, I think is enough also to make it a interesting screenplay as well. So explain that more, Chrissy. So you're trying to tell me, or what listeners know, like, example, do you know any films that, I mean, there's a lot of films that do that, right? But what is an example that came to mind since you just seen, like, a Stepford Wife thing or something like that?
Well, it's just that I think what impressed me about it was just that, like I said, it was the reversal of the usual trope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're expecting, like, okay, for example, like, I watch a lot of true crime. And so in these true crime things, they always have a formula. And it's like, okay, here is the downtrodden prostitute or the drug addict or whatever, and we're in a dirty alley and all of this, and you literally expect that this murder is going to happen. You expect that something violent is going to happen.
You hope?
Right. Well, something has to happen. My only comment was just that I thought that the parallel, the fact that he just kind of turned that upside down, and that, and the car, the type of car that was following him too, was funny because it was like this, you know, this like nice sedan, and it was white. And it was,
well,
like,
I, you know,
in the urban environment,
that,
we're like, oh god, scary.
That was a subtle clue that it was white.
It reminded me of like the Chevy Nova. That was you know, pimped up.
That's, yeah, all I wanted to say was just the point of that was when I saw that as the opening scene, my first impression was, oh my god, this is not what I expected to see in this setting in which he put it. And that was like, that's really awesome, because now I want to see why. It's just something I'm not used to seeing, so I want to see why I want to go
further. Well, and that's the thing that's cool, Chrissy, is that you looked at it that way, and I looked at it as how the characters felt. You looked at it as what the director was stating, and yet it works both ways. In other words,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, because I think there's plenty of people who have had the experience that you've had, you know what I mean, Phil, about being in these neighborhoods with these kids waiting to jump out. I'm not denying that at all. And I think that's another way to bring the audience into the story. I think you had both things working there. You had audience empathy, and you had that irresistible, and there's actually a name for that reversal, and forgive me, I can't think of what it is right now. There's actually a name for it. But I think the combination of that reversal and, you know, the audience empathy to kids who have been in that kind of situation is what made that opening irresistible. And what was also interesting was right afterward, you have this very dissonant score with the violins and the fiddles, and it sounds like some guitar, and it sounds like a twisting of the old spirituals. And it kind of suggests voodoo rituals with all of the whispering, if you listen to it.
I'm just going to interject, Chrissy. I noticed that music, and I noticed it specifically because I enjoyed it, and it had banjo in it. And those two things usually don't go together.
Yes, that's correct. And in fact, being the score slut that I am, of course I initially said, I have heard something like this before. Where did I hear it? What did I come home and do right after I saw Get Out? I put in the Stepford Wives. If you listen to the opening montage music when they are leaving New York and going into the country, this score was very much inspired. It is not the same, but there, by any stretch, it's not a copy, it's not the same, but there is some lovely suggestion. And then the composer put his own spin on it with the banjo, and the banjo kind of suggests almost a Southern sort of flavor, which is interesting too. Because
you might even call it rednecky.
Well, there's actually something here I'm right about that whispering. I found here that according to the words of the composer, Michael Avels, he said, I wrote some phrases these souls might say, and that Red Soul Healy translations allowed to see what mus- what music occurred to me. Out of the process, I wrote a couple of demos, and Jordan chose one of them. Minor Trouble, Zikilza Wakinga. I'm butchering this badly, but it's a different language. It's Swahili. And it says to be the main title for the film. The translation for some of the poetic licenses: brother, listen to the elders. Run, brother, listen to the truth. Run, run far away. Save yourself.
Well, wow, that's actually fantastic. Thanks for looking that up. That's really great.
And
I tried to see if I could buy the actual score, but I don't think it's available.
Not yet, at least.
It's on iTunes.
Oh, it is?
It's on iTunes? Okay. Yeah, I don't have iTunes.
The Motion Picture soundtrack is on there, and I actually bought this song. I have a hookup through my mixing board here. If you'd like me to play some of it now, I can.
You mean the song that was in the car?
At the beginning of the movie?
In the opening, yeah.
No, yeah, that not in the car, but right after that scene.
Oh, okay.
You up for it?
Go ahead.
All right. Yeah, give it a few minutes so the listeners can hear it. I think.
A very unique sound to it.
Really so beautiful and so atmospheric. I mean, this whole movie had a wonderful atmosphere too.
Oh yeah,
I'm not going to get on Abe too much for his trying to pronounce that title because it is a whole bunch of consonants.
You know what's awesome about that song? I mean, it's spooky anyway, and it's awesome. But it could have been something like Goldsmith could have wrote. But it reminds me of a combination of country and blues mixed together, and that's what Elvis and all these folks did. Was they took white country music and African American blues music, and then they merged them together, and they came up with what we got today. Sounded like. Go on.
Yeah, the voodoo thing is definitely there as well. Somebody mentioned a voodoo thing, and I can't disagree with that. That's in there.
Yeah, it's that.
Yeah,
it's
and I stand corrected. It is available on Amazon Digital. So you can get the entire score as well as the song that Eric just mentioned. You can get it on digital.
Plus, there are some sound clips from the movie. There are some great one-liners in this movie, and the soundtrack has some of those in there.
Oh, great. Yeah, I'm definitely going to pick this up because it's pretty awesome. And also, go ahead.
Oh, just a little thing before we go too deep. The quality of this film is really fantastic, and apparently from a bit of a trivia I'm reading here, it was filmed within 28 days.
What?
Yep.
Wow, okay, cool.
Sometimes when you got real passion for something, that's what you need to do, is just do it all in one shot, and don't stop and don't slow down, because you might miss the intensity.
Yeah, but
I really believe in that.
But this is a relatively small-scale film.
Right, right.
You know, mostly in one location. So...
Yeah. At all.
But I'm sure what he did, and because they worked on the screenplay, I'm sure this is how you do good filmmaking, is they planned it out ahead of time so they didn't waste time and money.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It also, apparently, it was filmed in Alabama. It was totally filmed in Alabama. It was not.
Yeah, it was.
The scenes we see in New York City are not in New York City.
Fairhope, Alabama.
Fairhope, Alabama.
And what's interesting, too, is when they get to the house... the house they arrive at, the parents' house, is also kind of foreshadowing, but the house itself is a loaded image. As long as we're talking about the Southern kind of influence in the score and stuff, the house is like a Southern colonial, and it's got the rocking chairs on the deep porch, and it just harkens to a time in pre-Civil War history when slavery was still the norm in the South.
What was the name of that? What was the name of that town again?
Fairhope, Alabama.
Okay, go on, Eric.
I was just going to say, I have to admit, the first time I watched this movie, I was confused. I thought they were down south.
They're not.
Setting of the movie, but upon my second watch, I realized they're probably supposed to be in
upstate New York.
Yeah,
that's my guess.
Well, in fairness, living in upstate New York, we don't have a shortage of racists up here.
I realized that. But
well, and
have
also
a whole lot of houses that look like that.
Well, yeah, but in all fairness, in upstate New York, as well as here where I live in southwestern Connecticut, there are a lot of really beautiful homes that are in a southern colonial style or a federalist style. I mean, some of these people that have a lot of money, they will build these mansions that do kind of suggest, you know, the old plantation homes, or in some cases, like around the area where Mike lives or around down near Sleepy Hollow, you are driving into a town that is full of all of these houses that were standing, you know, 100, 200 years ago, because this is such the oldest part of the country. But I noticed that because I was like, well, that's interesting, because, again, it's going from, just like Stepford Wives, going from New York City to upstate New York, and Stepford Wives, they came to Connecticut. But I think it's obvious that the reasons that they probably chose Alabama, I mean, one of the reasons, I'm sure it was budget and some other stuff and atmosphere, but it may have been because they really wanted this type of old South imagery. Because when you see that old southern porch with the things, it conveys a very specific subliminal message.
Well, he does end up picking cotton at the end of the film. I mean,
oh my God!
Dude, I was going to mention that he's not wrong. It's in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, the reason I was asking the town is because I've been to Fairhope, Alabama. That's a buddy of mine down. Just outside of Mobile, and that's where it's at. It's a suburb of Mobile. So that's why I was curious. I think they probably chose the location because of, a lot of these states like Louisiana and Alabama are trying to pull in a lot of film industry. It started with The Mist, you know, the Stephen King, Frank Darabont film. So it doesn't surprise me that it could have just been that and not even on purpose, like you said, Chrissy.
There's also other subtle stuff, like when they get into the house, there's a lot of old southern, old world type furnishings. There's the portrait of the family patriarch on the wall. There's the old world map behind them.
But you know what, though, Chrissy?
The plantation, cool, I mean, house. It's just interesting.
I don't know about where you grew up, but where I grew up in Massachusetts, we had as many Yankee families as the Irish, Italian, and Portuguese and Lithuanians, that you could go into a lot of these buddies of mine that happened to be Yankees that had stuff just like this. So I don't know if it's necessarily Southern. I think it may just be Brahim, maybe.
Well, it's still trying to suggest, I think, subliminally something. Old world values, maybe, then? Throwing us back in time? I mean, they're so wealthy. Why don't they have a? Here's the thing.
But you can see. But
why don't they have a freaking granite topped kitchen counters? You didn't see any of that.
No. I'm not. I'm saying.
You know what I'm saying?
No, you got me completely wrong, Chrissy. I'm not saying that you're wrong. I'm saying that that's not just a Southern style. That's what I'm saying.
No, but it's a stereotype. It kind of fits the cliche.
Okay, because I see that. I saw all that shit all the time when I grew up in Massachusetts. Never mind. Here in New Hampshire. So, but maybe you're right. Maybe it is a stereotype of the South. But for where I grew up, it didn't occur to me that they were doing the stereotype, if that was the case, because I saw all this type of stuff where I grew up in my part of the country, which is not near the South at all. So I don't know. I mean, so yeah, maybe you're right. It just, you know, Abe, you live in, grew up in the same area I grew up. You've seen all that shit, right?
I've seen some shit here and there. I mean, I've never been exposed to it. Maybe someone else has actually had to live.
No, I don't mean the people. I mean the stuff, the way the house looks. You know the decorations of the house.
Oh yeah, I've seen it here and there. I mean, there's certain place areas around here where the houses are fucking fancy as hell, and you know, some places thinking like, you know.
Yeah, Abe, Andover Street, right on town. Yeah.
Well, I, at the very least, you could say that they couldn't have made the house any more white without putting plastic on the furniture.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, well, I think it's just a suggesting of old world out values, but I did the house itself that they picked is specifically Southern colonial.
It's not
a Northern style. I did look that up.
I like how Chrissy put it, which is it's the old-time values rather than the heritage part. Because, like I said, where Abe lives, there's a street called Andover Street, which is like just like this, and houses do look have this Southern-style look. And it's not necessarily being as, you know, a ethnic Yankees-type person because, I mean, Paul Tsongas, Senator Paul Tsongas, you know, he's Greek, and he lived there. The Demoulas family is Greek, and they lived there. And so I guess it's
but you're also talking New England, not well known for its ethnic diversity.
At least you mean racially, not heritage-wise, right? Because
right.
Because New England is filled with different ethnic backgrounds, but maybe not, yeah, maybe
they,
not.
They have all types of white people there.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
What's the line from Blues Brothers? We have both country and Western, you know?
What type of music? Yeah, that's a good point. And that's probably the reason why I felt normal to me and that it wasn't making a statement. But I guess you're right. If you live in a different part of the country that is more diverse, you would say, oh, my God, that's typical whatever. So, that makes sense.
So back to the movie. The basic setup is that Chris is a black man who has a white girlfriend named Rose, and they are off to introduce him to the parents in what it turns out is upstate New York. And he's nervous because he thinks that she should have mentioned to them that he's black, and she hasn't, and he's worried about getting a negative reaction when he arrives.
Yep. And the thing is that everybody in this film is fairly interesting, normal looking, except for his girlfriend. His girlfriend is like the cosmopolitan playboy look, while everybody else is your next door neighbor, including the lead, I think.
Okay. I don't know what you just said means.
Well, I think it's similar to what Chrissy said about the house decor. They intentionally make the one character model material, and then everybody else normal. And I'm just curious if that was intentional. Okay.
He says normal, he means kind of homely.
Well, just your next door neighbor, average people. So, so I guess you're right, Mike. But not that the lead guy wasn't a good looking guy, but you know what I'm talking about. So, my point is that was that intentional statement by the director, or is it just a typical movie? Let's hire the hot chick as a lead type of thing.
Well, partly that, and it's really important to the story that she kind of be a hot chick.
Okay, so you think it was partly intentional?
Yeah, I think Mike's right.
Yeah, because she's already kind of.
I see what
she's already
yeah.
kind of angling for her own victim for her next victim at the end. So
so she has to. She has to be hot. So she has to.
Yeah. It kind of reminded me of the Nicolas Cage version of the remake of The Wicker Man, which we're not here to discuss whether it was good or bad or anything. But the whole prep point of that movie at the end was that these girls go out and get more. And so they were so much more, physically attractive and sort of bred to be that way. Because they were bait.
So, Chrissy, it's like, the female wolves who are in Heat purposely go into neighborhoods to attract the dogs to follow them, and then they kill the dogs and eat them.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting, too, because there's so much of that happens that's foreshadowed. Like, even when we first meet his really funny friend, Rod, who becomes the relief, you know, the comic relief. And he tells them, he's like, oh, I'm the TSA, and the next 9/11 is going to be geriatric shit. An 80-year-old is going to hijack a plane. And the subtext of that is it's really the foreshadowing of what's going to happen. What he's saying is people are not who they seem. People are not who they pretend to be.
Well, and literally the film is
the first 10 minutes.
And literally the point of the film is that there are geriatric people hijacking young, attractive people.
Oh my God, and how did I even miss that?
I until you just said it, I had it quick.
So obvious. I'm a dumbass. All right,
well, I hadn't thought of it until you just said it, and I was like, oh, wait a minute. Right.
Not only just young attractive people, young black attractive people.
But no, they make the point that black is in. So
they make the point that they're only doing it with black people.
Yeah, but they're implying that in 2 years from now it could be Arabs or it could be Hispanics or it could be
because the old guy is like fair skin used to be in but now black is in fashion.
right. So in 2 years from now the Norwegian fashion.
The listeners don't know what we're talking about because we haven't explained the plot yet.
Eric, but 2 years ago it was the Norwegians, and now it's the black people.
Swedes!
With Swedes, they're all Swedes. So, basically, the boyfriend gets to the parents' house, and there's this really awkward introduction where the dad keeps on saying things like, "My man," and "How long has this thing been going on?"
Yeah, and the dad is... He's like whiter than rice. Okay, I'm gonna go there. So it's just
And Bradley Whitford was really fantastic in this movie, even though I kept on wanting him to be Michael Gross. He does a really good job.
Oh, it pissed me off because I'm trying to say, who the fuck is this guy? I know this actor, and then it finally occurred to me that it was the guy from Cabin in the Woods.
he was wearing a lot of makeup in this movie, and a beard, and white hair. So I didn't recognize him either, Phil. Don't feel bad.
Okay, good.
So there's this really awkward scene, which I want to talk more about later after we expose the end of the plot. And if you guys don't mind, I'm just going to fast forward through the basic plot real quick, and then we can circle around and hit.
Yeah, go ahead.
So to power through it, they're having tea, and it comes up that the parents are having a whole bunch of their friends over this weekend for a gathering that happens every year, and Rose had forgotten about it. So Chris is going to be here for this whole big gathering of rich white people, which becomes really, really awkward because white people be white.
Actually, it has the token Japanese guy, too.
You're right. There's a token Japanese guy.
You talk about racist.
He says the most racist thing of the bunch.
I'm trying to power through this, guys. At one point, Chris runs into another black person at the party and starts talking to him. But this black fellow is acting an awful lot like the other older white gentleman present at the affair. Until at one point, he takes a picture of a guy and his flash goes off. And after his flash goes off, the other black guy goes berserk and rushes at him and tells him to get out. And eventually they get him calmed down. I forgot to mention that the mother is a psychiatrist who's into hypnosis therapy.
And the father's a surgeon, which is they're both very important.
And the father is a neurosurgeon. So they are very educated and very well off. And so the mother kind of hypnotizes the guy who panicked so that he's calm again and he leaves the party. And at one point, she actually hypnotizes Chris and gets him to quit smoking.
Unwillingly.
She hypnotizes him in a scene where she kind of does it without him volunteering.
Because it turns out she's a smoke Nazi.
Yeah, she is a smoke Nazi, big time. and there's something I want to mention later about that scene, too. But so she hypnotizes him unwillingly, and he starts having all these weird experiences and thoughts, including the fact that now the thought of smoking makes him sick. So she at least successfully got him to quit smoking. So he's been hypnotized, and he quits smoking, but it's his hypnotism is having some other side effects that are confusing to him. At this point, basically during the party, we figure out that the reason all these rich white people are here is to bid on Chris. Apparently, he is being auctioned off, not unlike the slave auctions of old. So that happens, and he is won by a character played by Stephen Root, who some might be more familiar with as Jimmy James from News Radio. his character wins Chris in this silent auction.
And is he the blind guy? Was he the blind guy?
Okay, yeah, the old photographer.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay.
And at this point, Chris is really just wildly uncomfortable and wants to leave. So he talks Rose into leaving, and or at least he thinks he does. But then they go up to pack, and he discovers a box in the closet that has a whole bunch of pictures. And earlier in the movie, she had told him that he was her first black boyfriend, but he finds this keepsake box full of pictures of her with black dudes that sure look like they're her boyfriend. Including somebody he's met who's one of the groundskeepers.
And
the dude we saw at the beginning of the movie.
Nope, the lesbo. They've got her with a woman who is the housekeeper.
Well, yeah, there were like a dozen pictures. You just can't say and expect you to pick the one you're thinking of.
Well, those were the only ones that were actually in the rest of the film.
So anyway, Chris is wildly uncomfortable and wants to leave, but figures out that Rose is in on this whole thing. So he's trying to get out of here and hoping that she'll at least get him the keys to the car so he can take off. But she realizes that he's trying to escape at this point. And the whole family kind of converges on Chris. There's a post-hypnotic suggestion that they use to just knock him out and drag him down into the basement where they begin to prep him. And it turns out that what's been going on this whole time is that the hypnotist mother and the neurosurgeon father are combining their powers to condition the mind of black people to accept pretty much a brain transplant. So they take a crusty old white person who's paid them a lot of money and take most of the brain out of their body and take most of the black person's brain out of their skull, except for just a little teensy part that they need to leave in to keep the body functioning correctly so that the white person gets to live in the black person's body, even though the black person is still in there and can see and hear everything that's going on. Which, when you think about that, is just fucking horrifying.
Yeah, actually, Eric, I don't know if...
I have no mouth and I must scream.
Actually, Eric, I don't know if this guy read the book, but John Mayberry, the horror author, wrote a book called Dead of Night. And the first person that gets infected, part of the book goes through his perspective, so every like fourth chapter, and he's a zombie at this point, but he's in there and he can see what's going on, and he can see himself eating, you know, dead corpses and attacking people, and he's screaming help and all that, but he can't do anything. And I'm curious if he got that idea from, say, a book like that, or he just coincidentally picked it up himself.
I don't know, but it certainly was effective at being disturbing.
And they portray it pretty well with the dream sequence, because it's similar to that.
A sunken place, which is really cool.
Sunken place, right? Yeah.
I wish I could place it, but I know I've heard that as the idea of being the rider trapped in the body. I've heard that in other places.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it originated with Mayberry, but it's nice. I haven't seen it, I don't think, in a lot of films, so it was nice to see it pulled in for this.
Right.
Yeah, it's a cool visual, too. It's like an abyss that they're constantly floating in. Looking at a TV screen, like a window.
Right. No, it's a very cool visual. And I particularly enjoyed the fact that, like Christy was saying, about 20, 25 minutes into the movie, I thought I knew what was going on. I was like, oh, well, it's obviously that the mom's hypnotizing all the black people so that they'll do what she wants. And it turns out that's not what was happening. What was happening was even More awful
more
than
nefarious.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was very pleased with that turn because it really took it somewhere. I mean, even if it had just been hypnotism, I still think I would have enjoyed the movie a lot. But the fact that it took the kind of 90-degree angle there really
they were the black folk weren't just sex slaves. They were taking their brains and getting rid of them.
Right. Right.
Yeah, and it was almost like a it was almost like a modern day version of the robots that you saw in the Stepford Wives because they were taking it a step further.
Ah, you told me that they're robots. I didn't know that.
Oh, sorry. Well, Phil, it's a classic. You should have seen it. But anyway, it's still good. You should still watch it. It's fine. And honestly, if you've seen Get Out and now you sit down and watch The Stepford Wives, I think you're going to enjoy The Stepford Wives even more because you're going to see some really fun parallels. And I just think you'll still enjoy it either way. But yeah, I like the idea that they kind of – it was an update on the idea that was much scarier because now our technology is different too. And the way that the things that we know about the brain are so much, we know so much more about our own mind and our consciousness and our emotions and things like that. We're so much more into that now than we were 40 years ago. And I just think that was really refreshing and cool. It was awesome.
And the main thing they learned is that white minds want black bodies.
So,
oh my God, when that woman at the party was like touching him and going, oh, is it true what they say that it's better?
Oh God.
Yeah.
That was so toe curling. It was just
And I promise you that Jordan Peele or someone in that has heard that. I promise you.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they have. I'm sure. That's why it was just so creepy.
Chris is tied to a chair in the basement where they have a television in front of him. And he basically ends up having a conversation with the Stephen Root character, telling him what's going on and that he's going to have his brain transferred into his body, but he'll still be in there to see what's going on the whole time. And because of this post-hypnotic suggestion that was put into him by the mom, anytime he hears the sound of a spoon tapping on the teacup, he gets knocked out. They have a recording of the tapping on the teacup on this screen that he's watching, and eventually he figures out that's what puts him under. And like Mike said earlier, he's kind of clawing at this chair he's strapped to, and the stuffing starts coming out of it, and he literally picks cotton to save his own life and stuffs the cotton into his ears, so the next time they play the recording of the teaspoon tapping, he pretends as if he's knocked out, even though he wasn't, because he plugged his ears. So he is then able to make his awesomely violent escape and burn the house down and get saved by his friend from the TSA.
Yeah, it's straight horror, and the social commentary disappears for that 30 minutes in that last act. It's like crazy.
I don't even know if it's 30
minutes. Oh, no, it's there.
They certainly backload the violence at the end of the movie. That's
right. Oh, yeah. But there's also a moment towards the end where you think it's going to go for a cruel twist ending. Show up, and you're thinking,
it was going to be a Night of the Living Dead where they just shoot the guy. Yeah, yeah, that's what I thought was going to happen.
Oh, and that was completely intentional, too. I've read an interview where Jordan Peele did not want people to be cheering when the police showed up.
And it worked. Everybody groaned. In my audience, the cop showed up, and everybody went, oh, shit, because they all were thinking it was the cop at the beginning.
Yeah, that's what
It would have been an echo. Yeah. It seemed like it was a callback cop at the beginning who was checking his license.
Well, it
felt like.
He was guilty as hell because he had killed at least three people, because the two black folk that were now the grandparents' brains were in them, and then the daughter, and they were all... I mean, he was going to kill so he would have been arrested.
Phil.
Yeah.
Well, you're right. He would have been arrested.
And yeah, he would have been charged with all those murders.
Here's the thing, though.
They would have just shot him dead.
Let me get this. Well, yeah, that might have happened. But I would classify what he did as self-defense, since they had him strapped to a chair and were about to replace his brain.
Oh, right, right. If they could prove it.
if they could prove it, yes.
But, right, but if you drove up on the scene where there's three dead people.
Well, no, and, I get it. And that's why everybody groaned when the cops showed up, because they're like, oh, fuck. He went through all that, and now they're just going to shoot him dead.
That's right. That's how I thought the movie was going to end. And I was going to go. I was going to think. I don't know if I would have liked it better that way or not, because that would have been more ironic and more, fuck you to society, as what some of the movie was possibly saying.
Right.
Or for him to being saved and actually drive away without. I don't know. I mean, it could have been. If it went the other way, it would have still worked awesome, too, I think.
Well, my hope is in 20 years that some of the bite will be taken out of that moment. We are all really, really sensitive right now to the whole like Black Lives Matter thing and hands up, don't shoot. And that's obviously what that's playing with. And that was set up, as Chris said, with the cop earlier in the film. And I don't care what the ethnicity of the character was. When you have one person standing over like three dead bodies, that's not going to fly well. Then you add the fact that it's a black man in a very, very white area, and who knows what would happen. Yeah, you could see where they were going, but it was so obvious they were going there. I'm glad they didn't. Plus, and my understanding is that was the original intent, was to have him get shot.
Oh,
and
really?
They realized they couldn't do it to the audience, and so they apparently didn't even film it. So there's not like there's a secret dark ending, but that was the thought, and I'm glad they did, because this was a triumphant film for the character. And there's enough shitty things happening in the real world, especially with issues of racism. I don't think they needed to go there, and I certainly can't imagine that. A whole lot of the black audience was going to see it wanted to go to watch the black guy get shot at the end.
Right, right.
So I think they made the right thing.
Yeah, and that triumphant overtaking too that he does at the end, that's all established in all the different three beats they have going on. There's like the foreshadowing that they hit the deer,
right,
which is an echo of him hitting the tree at the end.
Yep.
But then following that, you have the three beat of the stag, which is a huge symbol. The teacup is a three beat.
Yep.
The beating up, you know, the bad ginger kid, the brother Jeremy, that works itself out as a three beat with the
beating
stag.
Beating him up with
the cotton in the
stick.
Chair. It's really about freeing himself too, because like even the whole worrying of the chair thing is a three beat, right? Because the first time we see the chair, he's gripping the chair arms during the hypnotism.
Right.
Right.
Yep.
And that's where we find out where his mother dies, what those circumstances were, and how it affected him, and that this has oppressed him. Right.
Also, didn't his mother got hit and run, right?
Yep.
Oh, yeah. And that also is echoed at the end. That's what I'm talking about, how brilliantly this thing is actually structured.
And that's where I got the deer dying at the end, and it affected him. I mean, at the beginning, it affected him was because it was like his mother who got hit and died. There's nothing.
Yes, no exactly.
Well, yeah. Right. And this is, and Pam asked me to point this out, so I'm going to have to. Not that, I mean, because I guess she talked to somebody who didn't get it at all, which is that they set it up that his mother was killed in a hit and run accident, and he was home watching TV, and his mother basically sat out in the middle of nowhere dying alone for hours.
Right.
And he's always felt guilty of that, for that, somehow.
And right, so that, because he never, for not making it home in time, he didn't call anybody to ask them to help.
And the whole that whole scene was so effective because of just how the actor just managed to sell that grief that was being brought back to the surface through the hypnotism process. That was like the big scene they were really marketing, and it's really an effective scene.
And Mike, so continue that. So.
Well, I will say this is a me thing, but when I think of deer, for whatever reason, the thing that always stands out to me are their eyes. For others, it's their antlers or their little fluffy white tail, whatever. But for me, it's the eyes. And with this actor, right, when you have like the extreme close-ups of his face,
oh, the deer
being hypnotized,
and
you've got
that
deer in the headlights look, and he's because he does have these very, very expressive eyes, and these very, and it gets those very sort of sad, terrified eyes when he's being hypnotized in other moments, or when he's strapped to the chair, and I think it works great. So even that ties in with the deer motif, but the idea of so. You know, then he hits the deer, and he's got this feels bad about the deer dying again. He doesn't want to leave the deer to die alone, sort of in the middle of the woods, whereas his girlfriend doesn't give a shit. And then when he kills the father, by stabbing him with a mounted deer head.
Right.
When he gets there, he said, and they tell the father they were late because they hit the deer, and he starts talking about, well, oh, there's too many of those around here. We ought to just hunt them off and pick them all off. We should get rid of them all, as far as I'm concerned. And that actually, referring to a black man kind of as a buck, is, I guess, an old racist term.
Right, which is completely opposite from Cure or Wellness, where they said, I don't have the heart to kill all the deers on the property.
Was represented, and well, the deer there represented innocence in here. And then, of course, at the end, he hits the girlfriend and leaves her to die alone in the cold, just like his mom. And he does it as an act of sort of cruel vengeance. And so I guess what Pam was talking, whoever she was talking to, I don't remember, was saying, I don't understand why he would do that, you know, just to leave her to die the way his mother died. It's like, because it's a horrible way to die, and he wanted her to die horribly, you know.
She's lucky.
Well, and it was also a symbol of him freeing himself from the oppression of that weight, like I was trying to say about the three beat of the chair. The second beat is when we see him as a kid in the past. The third beat is when we see him tied to the chair at the end. That also ties in to the stag.
I want to get back to the scene of where he left her to die, because I could see him just wanting to kill her and was going to kill her. But I think you're right, Mike, which is it was more to make her suffer. And he knew she was going to die anyway, so die. It's just that you're going to suffer while you die rather than kill you instantly.
She didn't deserve his sympathy. That's it.
Right,
and
right.
I think this is it. When people, the audience, loved her death. Right. They cheered her death. And it's because, the dad is a dick, but he was kind of been dickish the entire time, you know, and been creepy the entire time.
She betrayed him the most out of everybody.
Right. Exactly. And for most of the movie, this is sort of like
her for 6 months.
Right there. For most of the movie, we think she's on his side. Right. She's sympathetic to him and she's going to help him. And then you get that moment when he's like, get the keys. And she's, give me the keys. And she's like, I can't, I can't do that.
Yeah.
And you're like,
she's betrayed so many people.
Well, she betrayed the trust of the audience.
Yeah. It's both within story and out of it. She's been a chameleon betraying the trust of everyone. As you said, both viewer and character. So, she's probably most malicious because, her brother was obviously unhinged. The mother was very calculated and very cold. The father was really, like, you can see signs of just crazy there. But it was the daughter who was almost, for the most part, acting like a normal person. And at the moments when she's confiding him near the riverbank, saying that, they can leave and give him that false hope.
Well, also, too, that pissed me off about her, too, was that she was more of she kind of, when you look back, was the one that was putting him, it was doing the exact same thing as the father, because she was the one that says, oh, the cop can't do this to you. This can't do it. Or my parents are embarrassing.
Yeah.
Look at, and it's like and everything she's doing is using identity politics. But go on, Eric.
Well, and that's exactly what I was going to point out about that scene with the cop. Is that she wasn't actually trying to protect him. What she was trying to do is make sure there's no paper trail. because she's taking this guy to his disappearance. She doesn't want a cop with a record in his log that he saw this guy that she's essentially kidnapping, even though he doesn't know it at the time.
Yeah, I think that this is one of those situations where when you look back, when that wonderful surprise at the end that she's in on it is revealed, you can look back at everything that she's done and said and go, oh, I get it now. But it But while you're watching the film, you don't pick that up.
Well,
and right, that's why it's brilliantly done. For the first time, you don't pick it up. That's
and just like the rest of the family would be telling him these things that they think are comforting, but aren't. You know, the I voted for Barack Obama. I love Tiger Woods, you know, and all that stuff. She says to him probably the cruel, what seems to be the cruelest thing she could say to him, which was that, I just want you to know, you were one of my favorites.
Right, right.
Not even you were my favorite. You were one of my favorites.
And speaking of things you don't pick up on the first time through the movie, I want to talk about a particular section of dialogue, which is when... okay, we didn't mention the servants very much when I was doing my quick plot run through. There are two servants at the house. One's female, Georgiana, and the other one's male. His name was Hank, I want to say. Was that right? Anyway, one of them's the groundskeeper, and the other one's like the maid. So when he's giving Chris the tour of the house, at one point when they're walking out back, he says to him, "Go ahead and ask." And Chris is like, "What are you talking about?" He's like, "I know you've noticed that we're white people and we have black servants." He's like, "Well, I wasn't going to take it there, but now that you mentioned it." And he has this line of dialogue that when you hear it the first time through, it doesn't mean what it actually means the second time you watch this movie, which is that he says, "Oh, well, we hired Georgiana and Hank to take care of my parents. When they passed, I just couldn't bear to let them go, but I hate the way it looks."
Because they are his parents.
Right.
So the first time through the movie, you hear him say that, and you think he means, "Oh, well, I didn't fire Hank and Georgiana, but I hate the fact that people see me with black servants."
I think it's and Walter. Isn't his name Walter?
It's Walt. Yeah, I was going to
say Walter. Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
But on the second viewing, you realize that what he actually means is that he couldn't bear to let his parents go, and they put their brains into Walter and Georgiana, and he can't stand the fact that they're black.
Oh, my God. I totally missed that, but that's one of those brilliant, again, justification things, like, which is why I think twist ending and surprise endings don't always work the way they're supposed to, because... you're not giving all of this backup for it. You know, that's where the twist endings fail. You know how sometimes you see a twist ending and it's like, okay, that didn't work, or that really didn't make sense. Right. 9 times out of 10, it doesn't, because it's not well built. It's not suggested subtly throughout the film enough. And that's where this movie just excels. It just gives you clue after clue after clue, but it's so subtle that until you know where the movie goes at the end, you don't get any of it. And that's
right.
The way it's supposed
yeah.
to be.
Right. And
that's
this
how
is,
it's supposed to work.
And this is not a mystery. I mean, if you've seen Stepford Wives or familiar with, you kind of get the idea where they're going, but I don't think there's anything there that, you know, will get 99.9% of the audience to go, "Brain transplant. I knew it. Brain transplant."
Right.
So, and I can understand how, and I think Chris Jenner had brought that up. He wasn't that happy with the twist. That is a bit of a science fiction-y jump for where the rest of the film was. So I can understand it might throw some people, and I get that. I think, though, they do seed it really well, so there are things that, again, you kind of go, you're not going to figure it out ahead of time, but when you rewatch it or when you think back,
well,
I think you're going to go, "Oh, now I get it." I'm not sure that he hates how it looks that his parents are black, because, again, he likes black people in his mind, but it certainly can work on that level, too.
All the science twist in the B movie Midnight Madness of the last act of the film is exactly what Chrissy said earlier, which is it felt like a 1970s film a lot of the time, and I think that was part of the intention as well. So for someone like Chris Jenner, one of our listeners who didn't necessarily like that twist, I think Jordan Peele's intent was to not only make a good horror film and in the real world, but he was also trying to make a B movie horror film on purpose too, and that's where he went. And I think if you know knowing that fact, I think it works. And Chrissy, you picked it up right away. You said, "Oh, it felt like a 1970s midnight film in a sense."
Right, and it's the kind of thing that I'd like to see more of in horror films, and that it is, again, I can see why some people didn't like it, but it just kind of out comes out in left field. It's a weird, just a weird-ass turn, and it's a fun horror film, and we don't see it. We just get a lot of very somber, serious films lately, or we get horror comedies. We don't get a horror film that has fun moments, and it's fun to watch.
Yeah, that's kind of like a throwback, in a sense.
Yeah. So it just really works on for me on all the levels. But even if that didn't work for you, I don't think it should be, because it's not really what the film is about. It's not the big part of the film.
Right.
And honestly, I think Cure for Wellness, which we discussed 2 weeks ago, was, even though it's not as good of a film, it was trying to do the same thing, where it was fairly normal, an interesting film, what's going on, and then suddenly it has the science fiction twist, and it has a B-movie madness for the last 30 minutes, similar to this film, even though they're completely different films. So I think maybe that's something going around right now in Hollywood, Mike, that maybe a lot of people are saying, let's do that. Let's go back to the 70s-type style of
film. It would be nice, and maybe we're getting more of that, and Split did it too. So
I do want to mention one more thing I picked up on, and this one is a real stretch, but I think it's funny to think about, which is that there's a scene towards the end of the movie where Rose is up in her room with her laptop looking up NCAA prospects, and she's got a little snack going on, and what she's doing is she has a bowl full of Fruit Loops and a glass of milk, and the way she's eating them is to put a Fruit Loop in her mouth and chew it, and then take a sip of milk. And if you really want to stretch, you can say that the reason that she's eating her cereal that way is because she doesn't want to mix the colors with the white.
Yes. Yeah, because if you're going to pick a cereal, and you want for color, I mean, it's going to either be Fruit Loops or Trix, right? That's about it.
Right.
Fruity Pebbles, too.
Or Fruity Pebbles, yeah. Yeah, I picked up on that, and that was neat.
Oh, Lucky Charms as well.
And I do like, there's a lot of white symbolism, for lack of a better term, in the film. There's a literal white, like the white car. They're dressed in white. But the things they do, like, you know, when they serve, you know, like the brother plays lacrosse, which is about as white a sport as you're going to get. Right?
Oh,
that they serve carrot cake for dessert, you know? Like, it's like, okay.
There's also a little detail about the grandfather, too, is that when they're looking through the pictures, they go through an old photo of the grandfather in racing.
Right.
And then we find out that he was at the very end of the film, when Rose refers to Walter's grandfather during the final chase, we find out, okay, that's the grandfather, which makes a scene in which while outside, Chris suddenly sees Walter running towards them and suddenly sprinting around at night. You figure out that, you know, he, because it's, during his racing career, the grandfather lost to, I suppose, the
Jesse Owens.
Name. Yes, thank you. Jesse Owens. And you're thinking, like, oh, he must have been really sore about that for a long time, and now he finally has the athletic prowess that he lost and might have a little more of. Because he was only outside running around because he was trying to exercise.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's right. His father was a track star, and so when he becomes, his brain goes into the black folk. He is now still doing track in the middle of night. Yeah, I get it now.
Right, and the thing is, if you think about it, with the parents, right? Because we see them as servants, but these are old people. They would have been, you know, they were around to race Jesse Owens in the 1930s. So the grandfather would have probably been well into his 90s at this point.
Yeah.
And grandma, probably the same thing. Well, you know, if you were like my grandmother, who would have been of that age, what was she going to do? She would be cleaning the house, right? Because that's what she did. That was what she was brought up to do. She was brought up to be a housewife.
Well, and I was going to say
that's another thing that Dad said on the way through the house during the tour. So they come into the kitchen and goes, oh, this is the kitchen. My mother used to love to cook, so we keep a little piece of her in here.
But also, Mike, we got to remember though that the grandparents only have to play servants for a handful of days.
Right.
After, after he's kidnapped and sold off, then they can become the patriarch and matriarch once again, once everybody's gone.
Right, but even so, I imagine Grandpa spent a lot of time outside with a young, fit body, running laps and chopping wood and doing physical crap because he's a 90-year-old man. He's not going to go inside and play Xbox.
Right.
Right? So even then, their behaviors seem less weird when you think, okay, if these were the owners of the house in the 1930s, they would have been doing the same damn shit anyway. They just wouldn't have been posing as servants. So, yeah, so it still kind of makes sense. I do got to give a lot of credit to the actress who plays Georgina, because there's the moment in the film where Chris snaps the picture, right, and snaps the flash, and the flash breaks them out of their hypnosis or for a second, and that allows some part of the original personality to come out. And you can see in her face, she's saying the right things, but there's absolute terror in her eyes. And just a phenomenal scene, a phenomenal little performance that she gives.
And it was all face acting. It was all her face firing that made it.
No.
Now, let me ask you this, Mike, and Eric, since you guys brought it up out of all of us. The mixing, the serial symbol and the white car and all this, and obviously you're trying to say that a lot of that was intentionally to.
Oh yeah, I mean they're just.
What does that mean? Does that mean this director has a true gripe about something or?
It's a film about racial tension.
Okay.
Centered on a black guy, so. Whitey. It's basically, I would imagine that just symbolically to reinforce the idea that the black guy doesn't really belong there. He's not in his home territory.
Right. Okay. Because some people who could look at this film and say, well, there's not one. Like a lot of films, like every man character, like Thelma and Louise, every man character is terrible. I heard in a lot of reviews and whatever. Here, could you say that every white person is bad and there's no good white people?
Yes.
Okay.
Here's the thing: one, you have the Stephen Root character, who's literally blind, and he doesn't. Okay. He's the one that you were really convinced where Chris being black doesn't matter. He just wants Chris's eyes and his talent.
Yeah.
Right. So. And that doesn't make him good, but it doesn't make him a racist either. So he is probably the most woke white person that's there because he really doesn't give a shit that Chris is black because he's blind. He can't tell. And we are dealing with a small knit community that of white people. So it's not like they could say all white people. We didn't get enough of a sample of white people to be able to say that. And you do get and they can't say any more than all black people are good because. You know, we didn't really see a lot of black people either. Most of them were either possessed. You had the black people as the security people, right, the police, that laughed at the friend.
Right.
You know, and what you can say is that that Chris seems to be a good guy and his friend seems to be a good guy. And I don't think you could use that to just draw, you know, it's sort of that, we can't have Chris speak for all black people. You know, we can't have, mom and dad speak for all white people, but it's a group of white people with this sort of passive aggressive racism, this nuanced racism that they don't even realize that they're racist. By the way, since, you know, not to, cause he does say, and you know, actually it was Bradley Whitford, I think you said, and Phil, you've used the word many times tonight, that it was a kind of criticism of white liberals. There are a lot of people in, so I can white explain this for everybody. There are a lot of people in black community that do feel like the white progressives sort of take advantage of them because they use them for their votes, you know, and then don't really deal with their issues. You know, they leave the water in Flint, Michigan to fest. You know,
that's actually a really large issue, I think, in the area where we live, Mike. Because we are north of New York City.
And not to get more political, but Chrissy, besides that, I mean, during a presidential election, right? Donald Trump said, "What have the white liberals done for you? Why don't you take a chance with me?" And whether that, you know, who cares the point? But the point is that's exactly what you're saying, Mike, which is the Democratic Party has done wants your vote, but then they still leave Flint, Michigan to shit. The point is that what Mike stated is similar to what was said in the presidential election, which is the one party that seems to be pro African American issues hasn't done anything.
Not anything lately anyway. But there's also a lot of distrust with the Republican Party, and I've talked to a number of people of color about that too. So it's and again, I'm trying not to get personally too political here. I don't want to introduce my politics into it, but I think this is part of what the filmmaker is talking about here. You know, is that's a big part of it. It's not just they only see us. It's not just that they thrive for us for our bodies in a literal sense. You know, they want us to be athletes and sex slaves. But just in the metaphorical sense, they want our bodies to show up on election day, and then they don't give a shit about us the other time. You know, we count in the ballot box, and that's it. That's, I think, another part of it. I'm not going to validate it or invalidate it. I'm just saying that's a perspective.
And the whole sex slave thing, how fucking funny was Rod?
That whole thing about Jeffrey Dahmer was
dying. That was so funny.
I actually thought, even though it was funny, I thought it was the weakest part of the film, because I just couldn't believe that someone would be that. I mean, obviously it was comic relief and all that, and looking at it that way as a midnight movie, okay, it works. But I didn't think it fit. I thought it fit least out of everything, because he acted so silly and nonchalant and ridiculous, because you can think that, okay, some folks, white folks may want to go after a black folk for whatever stupid reason, but he was just like over-exaggerated, I felt.
Well, a little bit, he's a caricature.
Yeah.
But he's a black caricature, he's a black stereotype, but, I'll go back to my grandmother again. My grandmother was a caricature of what an old Italian woman was, because there were a lot of old Italian women who are what the caricature is like. That's a particular style of performance that if a white person did it, it would be racially offensive. But there's a lot of black people who perform that way, for lack of a better term. It's a particular style of humor that is part of that culture.
Well, I see your point there. That, yeah, you could argue that may be an issue to the style. But I'm not talking necessarily the style. I'm talking about what he said, which was like, in other words, when he said, they want you as all black folk as sex slaves, at least the lead character goes, looked at him, and also the police people that he went to looked at him and said, like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. But I guess it was a good payoff at the end.
Well, I think the fact that he separated from the main story for the most part helped to compartmentalize that. I did like the fact that it answers some of the questions. Does nobody notice this guy is missing? You know, it's like, didn't he have a guy taking after his dog? Does he not wonder where Chris went? Why isn't he calling me? So I like that they kind of went back to that, because that's one of those plot holes that horror films would usually ignore. But yeah, there is a part of him that feels like he could have walked out of the latest Madea movie.
That, right.
Madea, what's that?
Yeah, you want to see black stereotypes? There you go.
If you did not see the preview for a Madea Halloween, then you are you should be very grateful.
I don't even know what a Madea Halloween means.
It's a Tyler Perry movie, and we're not talking the singer.
Okay, the only Madea I knew was from Jason and Argonauts.
No, just forget it. Move on. You're better off.
Yeah, definitely not. Yeah.
We have had to suffer. You deserve to suffer, too, so you have to see it.
Okay. So, one more random thing I just want to touch on real quick about this movie is that there's a whole hypnotism thing going on, and I actually texted Phil about this quickly as soon as I got out of the movie. My understanding of hypnotism, which, to be fair, is weak at best, but I thought that in order to be hypnotized, you were supposed to be relaxed. And when Catherine Keener hypnotizes Chris, she does so by scraping her spoon on her teacup. And, oh my God, that sound was the opposite of relaxing for me. I was literally squirming in my seat because I could not stand that fucking noise. I have no idea how anybody could be hypnotized while listening to that shit. It was awful.
Well, I think if I can make, you know, like we had talked about earlier, the teacup in itself was a three beat, which also tied into the other three beats. But the interesting thing specifically about that spoon noise, which was terrible, is that, believe it or not, that is, again, one of those very subtle allusions to the original Stepford Wives. There is a three beat in the Stepford Wives movie with a coffee cup and a spoon. And that's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
And it's very obvious. Unless you watch the movies back to back like I did, you wouldn't pick it up. But I saw that and I went, oh, that's that. I mean, that had to at least play a role in it. You know what I mean? It's a very specific reference. But
well,
I thought it was
okay,
clever.
That's all well and good, but I'm just saying, I don't advocate violence against women, but if Catherine Keener did that in front of me, I would knock that goddamn cup right out of her hand.
So I think it's just a rhythmic thing, and you know, in the defense of the film, that I don't know a lot about brain surgery, but I'm pretty sure you can't take a white person's brain and put it in a black person's body. Just
I'm pretty sure that doesn't work either. But
yeah, so
well, and I was really impressed with the gore.
When we got it, it was good.
Yeah.
Well, and it wasn't overdone. They really like even the actual violent kills were off screen, and then you saw the aftermath.
Was this, not that I should care, but was this rated R or PG-13?
I don't know. That's a really good question.
I don't know. It's let me look it up.
Yeah, I don't know
it
either.
Is
I would guess
R.
R, yeah, I would have guessed
okay.
that. Because the violence was pretty intense.
It was nice and like balanced, though, because it didn't just overdo it at times.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like the scene where he was cutting into the guy's brain and the fact that it was kind of like shielded
right.
and you really didn't get too much of that because they really could have gone over the top and just ruined the tenor
yeah.
of the film there and they didn't.
And the most violent acts of the film you don't actually see. When he takes out Catherine Keener, you don't actually see that. It's implied. When he head stomps the brother, you don't see that. It's implied. The only one you really actually get to see is the
father.
Yeah, the stag head.
Yeah, and the girl, too. Allison Williams with the
oh, yeah,
throat
yeah,
chest. Yeah.
But they did do it from the reverse angle. So you don't actually get to see the impact of the bullet. You just see the result on the other side.
Right, right.
So, yeah, it got violent towards the end. I don't... I'm still trying to figure out why this was. I don't remember what the different things are that they look for the different ratings. Off the top of my head, I can't think of why this was R, because I swear I've seen more violent things on primetime television.
Completely different rating system, but it's, well, yeah, I mean, Hannibal was all over the place.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true, Mike. Yeah, that was pretty graphic. That was very graphic, yeah. For TV, anyway. Regular TV.
Do you think they would think it would have been PG-13 if it was a white guy killing black people?
No. I this was usually the PG-13 violence. It's like James Bond violence or superhero violence where
yeah.
you don't actually see the blood and guts. This one here, you still saw some pretty vicious blood and guts.
Rated R for violence against whitey.
Well, I all I'm saying is, you know, I think the film comes out, it does really well, and then Colin Kaepernick says he's going to say the stand for the Star Spangled Banner again next year. So it has clearly healed the nation.
Oh, did he said that?
Yes.
Oh yeah, interesting.
I'm sure it has nothing to do with the movie and everything to do with the fact that he wants money for next year.
Yeah, because he's a free agent and no one wants to sign him because they're worried that he's going to make a scene. Yeah, that's right.
Or he can't actually play football.
Yeah, he's not too good either. All right, so, Mike, now let me ask you this. You were going to mention that you thought why it was good that people were able to cheer. Or is it just simply because they were fucking scumbag evil people?
I'm sorry, I got lost in that question somewhere. What was what specifically you're asking?
The chairs of the
Cheer. Not, I thought you said chair.
I have cheer. A bad box. My wife always says, like, I say beer and beer.
Yeah.
And I can't
pronounce. That's why I judge you.
Yeah, we're gonna Boston accents.
Yeah, we'll chain you to the chair and feed you to the hoppy.
Yeah.
I think it's they cheer because she betrayed him, right? I mean, it's sort of like Sharon Stone. You've mentioned Total Recall, which I hadn't made that connection until you brought it up.
Yeah, and
she totally betrayed Arnold Schwarzenegger in that movie.
That's right.
Right. So fuck her. And here she totally betrayed. Lied to us the entire time, suckered us, you know, and betrayed us,
right?
In a way that the other characters didn't. The other characters were assholes, but we already kind of knew they were assholes and villains because that's the whole reason we went to see the movie,
right?
You know, it's sort of, and this would be sort of like, you know, Donald Pleasant stabbing Jamie Lee Curtis in the neck at the end of Halloween. It'd be like, you know,
right?
You bastard.
Well, and I was talking about how I kept on wanting the dad to be Michael Gross. I kept on wanting Rose to be Jennifer Carpenter. For some reason, I wanted that to be, but it wasn't.
Sorry, I kept wanting Chris to be Neil Patrick Harris.
I think this was a way better. I don't think Jennifer Carpenter's character as an actress. I think she's so typecast now as Dexter's foul-mouthed sister. They needed an actress that could portray innocent, sweet girl next door.
I'm not saying she shouldn't have gotten the part. I'm saying that at certain actors, she like looked eerily like Jennifer Carpenter to me.
Really? And I said to you offline that she reminded me of a poor man's
Jennifer Garner.
Jennifer Garner, yeah, exactly.
Well, sort of like how I said offline last week, Eric, that every time I think of the 76 King Kong, I keep thinking Jeff Bridges is Kurt Russell from The Thing, because he's just because he's got the long hair and the beard, and that's just where my brain goes. It's just
uh-huh.
All right. Let's see here. How she reveals that she's part of the game and evil, even though I think we already kind of guessed it, right? Because he had seen all the pictures of her with the black folk. The way
they hide that really well until that reveal, though.
Right, but even after that, you still think she may be on his side because she's looking for the keys, and then finally she just suddenly gives up and says, you know, I just can't give you the keys.
Right. But, you know, and in hindsight, you know, when does she do that reveal is after there is space between them and the other males are in the room with her.
True.
Yeah, right, that's so. A really good point. Yeah, you're right, though. Once she's protected by her family, that's when she can kind of finally admit that, yeah, right, I'm in on the game. That whole scene also I thought was awesome, too, was because the whole film kind of, no matter how weird and spooky it was at points, it still kind of had this odd humor to it because of the awkwardness. Yet,
right,
at that point, he's in pure horror. He's saying, get the fucking keys, you know, and you know that he's actually in danger at this point.
Great performance.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it was awesome. Yeah. Yep. Awesome. And I think it's still at a pretty close to 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. It may still be.
It's 99.
Oh, somewhere.
Negative review. So it's 99 now.
Bastards.
Yeah. Now the one negative review, I haven't checked Rotten Tomatoes. The one negative review I've read, and I'm not telling you who it is. He is a movie reviewer for National Review, which is a politically conservative magazine. And he
is
one of the
Bill Crystal's magazine.
No, that's Weekly Standard.
Oh, okay.
But it is one of the he's one of the worst film critics. With his head too far up his ass. And, like, he didn't even realize that the guy from the beginning of the movie was the guy in the middle of the movie. So he's, like, asking what happened to the guy from the beginning of the movie, even though they go either way at least three times to point out that that's who that was.
Oh, right? That's pretty bad that he didn't know that, yeah.
All right, because they have Chris realize who he was. They have Chris tell his buddy who he was, right,
Right, and that's the reason why he's taking the picture, so he can show his buddy.
Exactly, so they do that, and then they have his buddy tell that to the cops.
Cops, yeah.
Right, so they've at least three times they explain to the audience he's the same guy. And this guy missed it. And the worst, and it says he complains about being a Get Whitey movie. Understand, this is also that I did not realize this until recently. He apparently is also a black film critic. So,
okay.
So it's not even like you could say, well, he's just a white guy who doesn't get it or who feels offended. No, he's just a fucking, and even like you read the comments from, you know, these, they don't like him. Nobody agrees with him. They all agree it's a stupid review. I have no idea how he stays on in the magazine.
Well, you know, just to bring up one quick point that's kind of interesting, you're bringing up about this one guy, and apparently he's black review or whatever. When I was reading, I was listening to a lot of the interviews on the Stepford Wives DVD, and one of the things that was really interesting that I didn't know about this movie, this is the part of the history, was that it didn't do well at the box office, and part of the reason it didn't was because a lot of women thought that it was an anti-women movie.
Huh.
And you watch that movie, and you sit there, and you go, how stupid are you to think this is an anti-woman movie? Because
there's
the opposite message.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if there may be people out there who are
stupid,
not understanding the message at all. Not to defend this guy. I've never heard of this guy, and I don't think I need to hear of this guy because he sounds like a moron.
Well, a reason I'm not mentioning his name. Look, he's the only negative review on Rotten Tomatoes. If you really want to know,
I found it.
You can find it.
Here's
but,
the last. I'll give you the last sentence of the review. Reducing racial politics to trite horror comedy. It's an Obama movie for Tarantino fans.
Okay, that doesn't even make any fucking sense. Doesn't mean
right?
Like Tarantino movie for Obama fans? I don't.
I don't understand.
I really don't get that. Shit.
Guy's an idiot.
Again, this is a review in a political magazine, in a right wing political magazine, though not one that's known for rabid, like, throwing out red meat. Even the readers of the magazine who are commenting below it are saying the guy's a moron. so even that this has nothing to do with Obama, that this is and just misses the point completely. So yeah, it's just.
Oh God.
Well, who knows? I mean. Yeah, maybe he looked at the Obama third term thing, or maybe who knows what he saw in it. But or, you know, so I'll give him some benefit of the doubt. But yeah, obviously he's watching a different film than most people, I would say. Let me ask you this, Mike, as a devil's advocate for this guy, because it appears this is where he was going. What did you think of when the blind guy says, "Oh, this has nothing to do with you being black." This is the hip thing right now, the black thing or whatever. Do you think that that could have been, like, here's a movie that's all, you know, whitey black, like you mentioned, Mike, and then out of the blue they throw that little line at the end. What was that, a cop out?
No, I don't. I mean, because there's some people. Well, you know, it was Obama, and that's part of it. Obama was cool, right? It's cool. We got a black president. That's cool. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't that they liked Obama personally. It was just that, oh, like, we like having a black guy in the office. You know, what was it? I can understand that if you're in, if you're in the position of an African-American in the United States, that maybe it is a little bit of tokenism, you know, as opposed to.
Right. It's the white guy that goes, the running joke when he first got elected was by some comedians on like Saturday Night Live was I'm not a bigot. I part of the history. I voted for the first black guy. You
right.
Know? And so maybe that's what they were trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's stuff like that. Yeah, I don't think I don't think it was specifically that, but that's, it ties into it. It's the whole, yeah, it was hip and cool to be black. It was an in thing. But oh, now we're gonna have the first woman. So who cares about the black? You know, it's just
right.
So, well,
Interesting.
So, yeah, we've been going for a while now.
All right. Well, and I think, Eric, that's, I mean, even though we have gone for a while, there's a lot to talk about from, as Chrissy said, I mean, even the wiki talks about how this guy really did use the Stepford wife as a template, and then there's all the political stuff, and then there's just the B-movie madness, and then there's just as a horror thriller film, and then also the just the interesting awkward things that I noticed too, like you know, in the first scene. So there was a lot of stuff to talk about.
Oh, no anyway. Doubt. This movie's got levels on levels on levels.
And yet, even though it is, as I guess, Mike, you mentioned, that it's kind of, quote-unquote, a political film or a commentary film on race relations, specifically white and black, you could go watch this film and not be offended or not worry about all that stuff, because it's just a damn good horror film all in all.
Right, and look, we've talked about films that are aimed at different audiences, like especially foreign films, and it's like, I'm not Korean, I don't get it, you know?
Right.
And so we can look at films like that, and we're like, you know, it's made in speaking to a particular audience. And so while this is a film about the black experience, or a part of the black experience in America, it is not a film just for black people. Right, I think I think anybody can get most of what it's saying. Although I also think that might have something to do with its 99% rating. Because let's be honest, I don't care how great the horror movie is, you're not getting like above an 80% rating, because there's just people who don't like horror movies. Mm-hmm. So I kind of get this. I would not be shocked if there are people who are like, no, I get it, and I'm totally with you, brother. Those white people are terrible. Racism is awful.
Well,
and by the way, did I tell you I voted for Obama 3 times if I would have had the chance? There are some of the reviewers that are exactly the Bradley Whitford character and don't realize they're the ones that are being made fun of.
And you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Mike. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and my friend Derek, who's kind of doesn't want to go see this movie, because he's surrounded by white people every day, and he's like, I don't want to do that to myself. I don't want to put that in my head and have to think about that after I see the movie. And I was like, you know what? Your sanity might be better off if you don't see the movie.
Well, really? I mean, well, like I said offline, you know, somebody told, right?
Uh-huh.
Somebody let our secret out. You know, they're going to have to answer at the next rally.
Well,
right.
Even though the particular circumstance of this movie is far-fetched and a little ridiculous.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
But still, you know, parties like that happen. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
those situations with white liberals being racist, even though they're not meaning to, that happens all the time. And like I was saying earlier, I can't swear that I haven't done it myself unintentionally. So yeah, I think that's more what he's thinking when he says he doesn't.
Eric, I could verify it. I felt offended when I met you in person. No, just kidding.
Well, you made that up in your head, Phil. So
well, and look, you know, and it sucks to go to a party and just, you know, have people pawing at you like you're a piece of meat. Abe will back me up on this, right?
Jeez. The best line, actually the most ridiculous line of the whole movie was, Obama was the best president of my lifetime. I almost laughed when I heard that, but that's besides the point. So.
Yeah, okay. So
okay,
Ronald Reagan was the best president in my lifetime. There you go.
But he doesn't want to bring politics into it.
Yeah.
No, I'm just making a point from a sentence in the movie. That's all.
Whatever.
But here's my question. Did you guys ever bring up what the Asian guy says at the party?
No, what? I forgot. What was it?
I just said that it was the most racist thing of the whole.
Oh, my God. He goes, can you give us your opinion of the African-American experience?
Would you say in this day and age is more positive or negative?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
But that's the sort of thing
dying.
Is.
That was so funny.
I actually recall during the auction, too, he was the only person
during the bingo using yellow stickers.
Oh, yes.
No.
I picked up on that. I totally picked up on
that.
Jesus Christ.
That's terrible.
Yeah, I caught that. Everybody else had red or blue, except for him. He had yellow.
That's terrible.
Oh, my God. It's fucking hilarious. If you watch the movie a second time, watch for it, because he's right.
This movie is totally worth watching a second time.
Oh, you're going to pick up so much stuff. And like I said, I could go on and on talking about all these three beats and how there's a whole other, like we said, we've got some other themes in here rather than just race. I mean, there's a lot being said about freeing yourself from the oppression of your own emotional baggage caused by your past. That's definitely a theme. Another theme is immortality. There's another theme of cultural identity. There's also a theme of self-worth running through this, too.
Yep.
What are you really worth? What are you worth to another person? What are you worth to yourself?
Not as much as Jesse Owens.
Yeah.
Chrissy, I learned most about the fear of being beaten up by high school students.
Yes, that was, yeah. Oh, and there's also the decaying, the decay and age. There's so much that can be said about
movies. Yeah, that's true.
There's this is one of those movies that seriously has like probably 9 or 10 different themes in it. Well, and they're all handled well, and it just depends on what you see when you go.
Right. And I'm definitely.
But it's all in there. I mean, it's deliberately all in there. It just depends on what you see.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to own this movie. And Daniel Kaluuya, is that how you pronounce his last name? As the lead, gives a phenomenal performance, and one of the best aspects of his performance is that you can see when he's put into these situations. You could see his gears turning at all times, like, okay, I wasn't really cool with that, what that person just said, but is it important enough to say something, or is this a situation where I walk away? I'm at my girlfriend's place, I don't want to make things awkward, but how much am I willing to put up with? And you can just see that battle going on behind his eyes constantly.
Well, because he's also in a position where he knows they don't know what they're saying.
Right.
They're not trying to be dicks.
Forgive them, Lord, for they don't know.
Right.
What
they're
say.
Pissing me off. But yeah, they don't know what they do.
Yeah,
right?
You just deal with it. It's like whatever. Yeah, I mean, they're not evil people.
They mean
ignorant.
Well. They're they're ignorant.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And they got tiny penises, so we have to.
I'm not Argentinian for the 20th time. God damn it. You know, so whatever.
Well, and with the cop at the beginning, he does it right there. You know, you can say, well, yeah, this guy probably wouldn't ask me for ID if I was white, but it's much easier to just show him my fucking ID and move on with life.
Yeah. Even Mike spelled my name the Argentinian way, and I
oh my God, get over yourself, dude. You are
when you're
not
a shark, you're a shark
again.
All the way.
I'm not Argentinian. God damn it.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, my God.
I have never thought of you as anything but a cracker, Phil.
Salty. Not even Ritz.
I'm siding with Eric on this one. Cause
totally. Not a townhouse. You're like a premium cracker.
I am what I am.
Oh, boy.
Do. Okay. All right, I think we've gone on.
Yeah,
I think we're at the point. We've hit the point of silliness.
Yes. And I don't even know if we really... It was very difficult to talk about the subtext of this film, and I think we did pretty good without getting too involved
in
it.
Hopefully, we didn't offend the shit out of anybody. I guess we'll find out.
No. Yeah. Fuck no. If we didn't offend the shit out of somebody, we did this wrong.
Yes. Yeah.
If you were not offended by this, I apologize.
Please send email to Philip and let us know.
I'm sure we offended a Norwegian out there somewhere.
Swedes! They're all Swedes!
Well, listen, I just hope everyone now has a better understanding of the black experience in America.
Now that it's Mike has been white-slained to you.
Eric, speaking of Norwegians and Swedes, Chris Genro, he writes about the South Americans, players, fans that throw urine bags at people. You remember that today on Facebook? Yeah. And I go, no, they're not South Americans. They're all Norwegians. and he goes, he didn't get the reference. He goes, yeah, it was pretty bad. I thought he would get the reference.
Come on, General. We've only been doing this shtick for like 2 years now, this running joke. Oh, they're all Swedes, yes.
Hey, Sweden!
Mac,
right. They're Norwegian, Mac.
Let's get on with this. My final thoughts on the movie.
What's your final thoughts?
Best horror movie of the year so far. It will probably end up being my best horror movie for 2017. I'd be really surprised if anybody knocks it down. Go see it. See it twice. Own it. This movie is great.
All right, very good. I would concur with Eric, except that I have no idea where it will stand at the end of the year, but I'm pretty sure it'll be in the top 10, if not in the top 5. Just for the fact that there's still 9 months left of the year. However, I know math is hard for me today due to some programming. I don't even want to talk about work. I recommend. This is a top quality film. It deserves the praise and the reviews it's been getting, except from that guy from the National Review, who's an idiot. I would recommend that you see it, though. I think it's going to last for a while at the theater, so even if you can't rush out, it'll be there in a week or two. So that's a good thing. I recommend. Chrissy?
I'm going to agree and echo what Eric said. I think I was pretty specific about how much I love this movie when we opened. High recommend. I'm going to own it. It is worth watching again. And, you know, honestly, especially if you're a writer out there, if you're a writer of any kind, if you write short stories, if you write novels, if you write screenplays, there is some awesome technique in this movie. So if you're a writer, definitely watch this to study it and learn from it. If you're not, just go see this because it's fantastically done. There is absolutely nothing in this movie that fails.
I'm offended, Chrissy, because you said, I agree with everything Eric says, but you don't even mention me. And I was the one that said it was a great screenplay at the beginning.
I'm sorry. I have now offended Phil, so I guess we've achieved our goal.
You are a bigot.
Phil is a fucking snowflake.
That's right. I'm a snowflake. And that's right. I have something to gripe about every day. Oh, Eric, your garage should have a second door. I don't believe it. It's ridiculous. It's justice. Anyway. Abe.
Oh, God. Sorry. I agree with what you said, too, Phil.
She just agrees with me more.
I'm a snowflake. Stop it.
Myself deeper. I'll go away now. God, we are getting silly. We're getting overtired.
All right. So, for my end, I thought this was a great, great film. I mean, I'm really happy I got the chance to see it. I thought we had a great discussion over it. There's a lot to dig into this film. And I really think there's some things we miss. And it definitely has a lot of rewatch value. You know, there's some things you can probably catch it the second time around. It's going to be in theaters for a little longer, so catch it as soon as you can. It's for me in terms of where it could be in terms for the top 10 or 20 horror films. It could be pretty up there. And although we're still pretty early in the year, this has just been a great, great start. I love this film. This is just a fantastic film that tackles subject matter in such a different way with clever dialogue. Great writing, it was just fantastic. So yeah, check out Get Out.
Abe, I'm offended.
Don't make a tumble, you asshole.
Mike.
Well, it's a film that's supposed to be commenting on the status of ethnic identity in America. I can't say how disappointed I am. Not even one gender fluid Polynesian anywhere in the film.
they're Swedes, Mike.
See, exactly. They don't address that. They're all Swedes. We're all Swedes, except for the Americans, because we're fucking awesome. But everywhere else, you're fucking Swedes. You're all equal. Inferior to us, but that's fine. But, look, it's obviously we love the film. Really good film. Well worth checking out. I strongly recommend you check some of the other Key and Peele stuff out if you're looking for a laugh. Just talking about race stuff in America, if you want some two of the best things I've done, and again, done with humor, was the Black Jeopardy skit on Saturday Night Live with Tom Hanks from last fall, and the 12th season premiere from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, where the gang turns black and sort of a Quantum Leap sort of story. They're great, but they're also sharp, insightful, but not like angry and judgmental, and this kind of fits right in with that. Also, the Nerdist podcast had a really good interview with Jordan Peele, so go look that up if you want to find out more about this film. And yeah, I'm hoping they do this film right in terms of like extras and commentary tracks and all the rest when it comes out, because this will be, if this is bare bones, it's going to be so damn disappointing.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, I'd agree with that. Yeah, because I definitely want to own this, and I'm just going to echo what Mike just said.
So you want to
no
own the
work?
You want to own it like a black man? You want to own it like a slave? Is what you're saying?
Yeah, I do, man.
You were such a white person,
and also
you're privileged.
You know
what
saying,
you're privileged.
Also, what she's saying is she agrees
privileged
with me and Mike.
Yeah,
this is a black film made by a black man, and you're trying to appropriate his culture.
Mike, are you being a misogynist here, yelling at Chrissy?
Jesus Christ. I'm sorry. I don't want to offend him, Marian American. I'm sorry.
Oh my God.
We have to piss off so many people.
Barbarian American.
Ovarian. Ovarian. Is that
Ovarian American? I've used that one term. Yeah, also.
Oh,
Unitarian American, you go there.
Oh my God, you're tearing.
I can't breathe.
Oh, jeez. Oh my God, it's terrible. Anyway.
All right.
And we're gonna go away from
now.
I'm gonna forget all about things with that are racially tinged and look forward to seeing King Kong. So.
Yes.
All right.
All right. So that's get out, right?
Yeah,
Eric,
let's get out. We need to get out. So
before we cause any more trouble.
Thank you for tuning in to listen to us talk about this movie. I am pretty sure I speak for everybody when we you know, this is coming up on a 3-hour podcast here, and we didn't even say everything we had to say because this movie's got so much in it. So
and we have to be very careful too, Eric.
Yeah, because snowflakes like you. Thanks for listening. Come back next week, and we'll be talking about something else.
Oh, wait, I forgot to say the N-word.
On the farm, every Friday, on the farm, it's rabbit pie day. So every Friday that ever comes along, I get up early and sing this little song. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Bang, 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 bang goes the farmer's gun. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, 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 run. Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Don't give the farmer his fun, fun, fun. He'll get by without his rabbit pie. So run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run.
run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, 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 rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Bang, 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 bang goes the farmer's gun. Run, rabbit, run, 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 rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Don't give the farmer his fun, fun, fun. He'll